Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the broadcast. Peter Werby here with you. And join me after a week's absence, Jelaine Jordan. Welcome back, Jelaine.
We missed you. It's so good to be back.
We missed you. So,
I missed you.
You were a big hit up at the Michigan Women's Music, what's the last word there?
Big hit.
Festival.
Festival, yeah. Well,
yeah.
You know, I was there among my musical sisters and played a lot of music, and it was really fun. And there was, as usual, a lot of political content. So it's not, I got away from it for a while, but it's not like I really got away from it. Let's say.
What's the it here?
The madness called the Bush administration.
Oh, yeah.
But I was away from it as in I wasn't getting the daily news accounts, but I was in it in that I was with this incredibly large group of political women.
Mm-hmm.
And
singer-songwriters,
yeah. and a lot of Alex Olson, who we've spoken about before, who is a poet, spoken word poet, who is amazing. AlixOlson.com, go and check her out. And a lot of workshops, you know, for weary activists. I told you I was going to that, and it was just kind of nice. We just kind of talked about our own weariness, and that alone kind of strengthened us all.
That's
at
good.
The core.
This was, I think I can say it all in one phrase now. That was the Michigan Women's Music Festival.
Yes.
A yearly event, a national, actually an international event, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Women from all over the world come to this, not just musicians, also festy goers, as we call it, just the women who come to the festival. So.
And you know, my only, I hate to, it sounds so strong to say, my only criticism of you is you're way too modest. Because the reason you weren't here for the show last week, as you intended, is you were asked to participate in the final ceremony.
I sang.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
You know, you've got to be a shameless self-promoter.
I know. That is probably one of my downfalls, but that's okay. I just love to sing, and I love to be on talk radio with you, Peter.
Oh, let me see if I can do this. No wonder if anybody's trying to call, they probably can't do it. Could you take the phones off? Yeah, all right.
No.
There you go. All right. So now the phones are off of hold, which they were. 313-298-WRIF. That's the Night Call number. 313-298-9743. Just think, Jelaine, the difference between how many times I give my website.
Yeah.
Peter Werby. .com, WERBE.com, and how little you do. People should go to Jelaine's MySpace page, which is what, MySpace.com, Jelaine Jordan?
Jelaine Jordan Music.
Yeah.
Jelaine Jordan Music.
There you go, which is J-U-L-I-N-E.
But if they go to PeterWerby.com, go down the left column, you can click right onto it.
Yeah, there's a photograph of you and me.
Yes, there is. We need a new one.
I was going to say, you know why we need a new one? I mean, we're colleagues, right?
Yeah.
But we're, someone said, I was up at the Dream Cruise on Woodward, and they said, is your girlfriend going to be back on? So we got to get a little space between us. That looks almost like a boyfriend and girlfriend photo.
Oh, it does? It looked like we're going to prom or something.
Well, no. We look pretty casual. But,
the hippie prom.
Yeah, the hippie prom.
We'll get a new photo. Yeah. How about if one of us, you know, kind of formally, as we sit here, you know, how we look when we're doing the show.
That's right.
That might be
cool. That's right. But we are pals.
Yes, we are.
Well, all the fun stuff aside, fearing a slide in the economy, the Fed, the Federal Reserve System, cuts its discount rate. I don't even want to begin. I can't even get my brain around it.
Do you know, when I hear that, it kind of goes, you know?
Well, think about this. It's an economic system in which the elites are the ones that benefit the most, right?
I get that. Yeah. I know that well.
And the intricacies of it, the mechanisms of it, are only understandable by a few. And I can't remember. I've been talking about this to people. I don't make a, you know, I'm not much, as you know, not much different off the air than I am in the air. So I can't, on the air, rather, in the air. Wow, man. But, you know, so I can't remember whether I was talking with people or whether I was substituting on a nationally syndicated show last week.
Yeah,
the
you've
week
been
before.
Working way too hard.
For me, for a layabout.
For my Peter Werby.
Yeah. But I was saying that, like, this guy I know who's this, like, big expert on the market. I mean, they're always, when there's a, let me see, what is it, a bull market, that's when it's expanding. Well, if you have a lot of money, it's pretty easy to make a lot of money then. But so many times, why are all these people, their stock just collapsing, and their business is collapsing? If they're so smart, what's happening to them? They overplayed their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that people are selling mortgages and bundling them together and subprime and all that, I mean, I try to read that because I figure I'm going on the air and I want to sound like I know what I'm talking about. But you know what? I don't think anybody knows what they're talking about. I mean, they do know the mechanisms, but, and again, I can't remember what, if I was saying this last, well, you weren't here, but you've seen any number of times those scenes on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange that is just absolute chaos and people bumping into one another and screaming. I mean, as Mr. Natural said, which is the character of R. Crumb, is this a system? I mean, is this because it's not about an economic system where people work and produce things for sale and other people purchase them. I mean, that's like fundamental capitalism. It's all about speculation. It's all about hedge funds. And please don't even, my wife said to me, what's a hedge fund? And I kind of know, I don't even want to say.
You know more than I do about it, I know that.
Well, I know enough to, to BS. But we do know that there is no such thing as a free market, obviously. I mean, this is these idiot conservatives are always talking about, well, you know, got to support the free market. Well, the Fed, the Federal Reserve system, has just thrown in tens of billions of dollars to bolster the system. If it would have been the free market, just all would have collapsed, right? That's what they should have, because now it's artificially propped up. Where the hell all these billions are coming from, who knows? But it turns out to be the recession that wasn't, which, of course, is real good, because who always suffers? You know, these guys will lose millions, but who gets hurt?
Right.
They lose millions, but it doesn't do much to them. Be a few, you know. 1929. Remember the images like stockbrokers jumping out of windows committing suicide. I mean, I don't know that if that ever even happened. It may have, but it certainly they weren't jumping out as many as should have. Right? I mean, who knows? I'll bet five didn't jump out of windows. I'll bet three didn't jump out of windows.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, during the 1930s, they drove Cadillacs and Duesenbergs and Bugattis, and they lived in these huge mansions, and they took trips to Europe. In the meantime, our grandparents and they were, they didn't have any money. They were, you know, talk about families lived on $20 a week, all that. So it's always the poor, as usual. What this turns out to be is a bailout for the rich. Let me see if I can get into the language here. In this article in the New York Times, the Federal Reserve saying for the first time that the recent disorder in the financial markets has raised the risk of an economic downturn. They took the unusual step yesterday, which would have been the 17th, of encouraging the nation's banks to borrow directly from the Fed, particularly to support home mortgage lending. Well, now people are starting to glaze over, all right? And I don't blame you.
Well, in a sense, though, I think right now this whole home mortgage lending and the whole housing market has become increasingly important to people.
Yeah. You know what, though? The stock market on Friday shot up 233 points to 13, so it was over 13,000 again. It was over 14,000. And, you know, I've asked, maybe some of you can tell us. I'll bet you, because there's
some experts out there.
Yeah, there are. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And I asked, what's that guy that does the Left Economic Observer? I'll think of it in a second.
Right. Doug Henwood?
Doug Henwood, exactly. I always say, what is that a measure of? 13,000 what?
Yeah, right. Please tell me. Left Business Observer, that's what it is.
Left Business Observer, yeah. Points. What? So what does that mean? So I never did really.
Is that like shells? Is that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Doesn't make a bit of sense. All right. Oh, here, I didn't even have this marked. Cutting the rate will, this is from the same article, will inevitably raise the charge that the Fed is bailing out hedge funds. This is all the rich guys that screwed everything up with bundling their subprime loans. And others who borrowed billions of dollars to invest in subprime mortgages, ignoring the risk that many of the low-income households who got these mortgages would default. So again, this is what I'm saying. They get bailed out. The poor or the, you know, not even the poor, now it's middle class, the working class. Lower interest rates raise the odds that risk takers can sell bad investments with less of a loss. So again, you don't have to pay the consequences if you're wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, even if you really tried hard, I mean, you can have one of those situations we've heard so much about. It's a middle class person that they have a mortgage payment of $2,000. And then one of them gets sick, right? Or the prime earner. What do they call it? Prime earner? What's the word for that? The major earner, you know, the guy that, or the woman these days could be just as easy.
The one who provides the most.
There's a phrase for it, though. Here, Alan Blinder is his name, but it should be Blinder. I mean, but his name is Blinder. You would be mitigating their problems, the people that have screwed up. He's a Princeton University economist and a former Fed governor, but I would count that as a social cost of saving the economy. So it's, and this is one of the themes of the show, it's blackmail. This is a system based on blackmail. So here's your choice. You can either bail out these rich guys that screwed everything up, and then the economy doesn't go to hell in a handbasket, or you can let them take the consequences of their errors like all of us have to suffer. And of course, some of us suffer when we don't even make errors, right? The company moves to Mexico or China.
Yeah.
You get sick and lose your health insurance and what have you. So there's your choices. Either you bail out the rich guys that are just these screw-ups, or you suffer recession, and the average person gets hurt even more. Nice. Is this a system? Well, we're always talking about, is the U.S. number one? Well, here, Detroit isn't number one either. Stockton, California leads the nation in foreclosures.
I thought for sure it was us.
No, Detroit's only number two. Only number two.
You know, it really is astounding when you drive around and you just look at on every block, there's so many homes. Yeah. And I'm all over the city for another little part-time job I have. And as I look around, it is so depressing. Just the weeds and the weeds coming out of the gutters, you know, trees growing out of gutters. And it's just like in certain areas, just a ghost town. Very sad.
Thanks. Number two in the nation was Detroit, where job losses in the auto industry drove foreclosures higher. One of every 29 households recorded a foreclosure filing here, almost double the rate of a year ago. So, Las Vegas, let's see, one of 31. Oh, up, yeah, it was third.
Vegas? Oh.
Vegas. Well, here, let me see who this. This is a leaflet put together by. Aren't these leaflets signed? This is McCowie, which is the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War in Iraq. But and you'll see why. Here, the state of Michigan is in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis. It's time for Governor Granholm to take emergency measures to protect the health and welfare of the poor and working people of Michigan in the midst of an economic disaster that has hit our state. By the way, you know, it hasn't hit everyone. If you think about, you go through Royal Oak. You go through Royal Oak on a Thursday or Friday night and you think, everything is fine.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, oh, yeah. Even on the block I live, you would never know that they're, you know.
Yeah. A recent study by by University of Michigan economists Joan Crary, George Fulton, and Saul Hyman's revealed Michigan has lost more than 336,000 jobs in the past 6 years is expected to lose another 33,000 in the next 2 years. That would be the longest stretch of job loss in the state since the 1929 stock market crash. Michigan is among the leaders in the nation in foreclosures. 47,000 households have had their water shut off in Detroit.
No water? No running water? What year is this?
Tens of thousands of homes statewide are without heat and or electricity. Child poverty in Michigan has risen statewide to nearly 20% and almost 50% in Detroit. Schools, hospitals, factories are shutting down in unprecedented numbers. Now, there are three Michigan statutes which allow the governor to declare a state of emergency during periods of crisis, natural or man-made, as it says, and provide special powers to meet the crisis. During the 1930s, the state legislature utilized its emergency powers to pass the Mortgage Moratorium Act, which was 1933. The act extended the redemption period during which homeowners could not have their property taken from them after foreclosure from 6 months, and they changed it to 5 years. Yeah. And so,
I think they should do that now.
Well, yeah, and that's what these people are asking for. The law was upheld as constitutional by the Michigan Supreme Court, and there's a similar moratorium in Minnesota. So on and on and on like that. So these folks are saying that they're calling on the governor of Michigan to do the same thing. Apparently, the governor of Massachusetts decreed a two-month moratorium on foreclosures, which is cool. And they're the people that are one of the local components of this National March on Washington happening on September 29th.
Oh, yes. And, yeah. And you're going.
I'm going. Well, I may go on the 15th, but I'll tell you. Oh, yeah. The 12th, here. This is how this group was with the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War in Iraq. They say, this is a joke. This is the richest country in the world. There's plenty of money to fund human needs. The problem is that rather than spending money to help the people survive the economic disaster we're facing, the money is being wasted in an illegal, immoral, doomed war in Iraq. The National Priorities Project says the war in Iraq has cost the people of the United States $450 billion that has gone from us, to the war industries. And it's 12 million has been taken from the people of Michigan to fund the illegal war in Iraq. And the National Priorities Project says that this money could have been used to build 107,000 new housing unit. Mm-hmm. And you can't be a conservative unless you don't support the Fed giving money into the system and letting the whole S-House collapse, right? And not support like 100,000 new housing units, which also would give jobs to the construction industry. It would also, this $12 billion could place 1.5 million children in Head Start, fund 581,000 four-year full-time college scholarships. Oh. Yeah, how about making college free in this country? Instead of having a war in Iraq, let's have free college, okay? Pay the health care costs of 7 million children for 1 year. Pay the salaries of 207,000 public school teachers. So this is where it's all going. Right now, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are costing us $12 billion a year.
Mm.
I'm
very
sorry,
grim.
$12 billion a month.
A month, I thought it was a little higher than that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very grim situation. I'm really depressed now, Peter.
Well, I know.
Anything good? You know, the one thing that I, when I got back to civilization, because I was in the middle of the woods with no updates on anything, and I hear, the first thing I hear when I get in my vehicle, Karl Rove is resigning. And you know what? I said, and you said the same thing when I called you. I said, oh, I hear Karl Rove is resigning. So what?
Yeah.
It's not going to make any difference.
Well, what the Republicans are trying to do is they're trying to unload the worst baggage that they're carrying. I mean, we don't even remember names like Dick Armey and Tom DeLay and what were some of these other people that have gone? Oh, yeah. Rumsfeld. So,
Rummy.
Yeah, I said to a friend of mine, I mean, who's the Secretary of Defense now? And they went, there's not these personalities.
But they're trying to make a personality out of this latest Secretary of Defense.
Gates?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know.
No. The commanding, whoever's over in Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
Things. They're trying to make his name a household name, but look, it's not working.
Oh, man. Yeah. Let's, if you'd like to call in, by the way, comment on any of this or bring up anything that's going through your mind. Peter Werby and Jelaine Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. For the bashful, and if the lines are filled, which they're not right now, you can write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Well, you sort of, I mean, all I got is a whole console here full of bad news.
I know, it's really depressing.
I don't know if I want to go on to...
Well, if there's any place that... This is the place to do it.
Peter. Yeah, yeah. That conviction of Jose Padilla. How are they saying his name in the news? They are saying Padilla?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's a Latino, so it would be Padilla.
Right.
Yeah.
They have it all wrong.
Yeah. Let's just quickly... Yeah. I mean,
what do you think, Peter?
I don't know.
Did I just set you off with that?
How about this? Although we had this, another version of this, Blue Lady sent this in. And there's a secret White House manual on how to stop anti-Bush T-shirts.
Oh, yes. these people really have too much time on their hands when they should be concentrating on some serious issues.
Yeah, one of the things that we talk about here is how much time. I mean, these guys never sleep. They are always trying to do something.
Bush gets 10 hours a night or something like that. Doesn't
really?
He go to bed at 6:30?
He does. He's in bed. But the Bush administration has agreed to pay, get this, $80,000 to a husband and wife who were ejected from a presidential rally because of their anti-Bush T-shirts. You probably remember in the last 4 or 5 years that there were all these people that were barred from presidential rallies.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, here's the president of all the people, right, forgetting about how he got in there and all of that, but he is the de facto president, and people have the right to come there and express their opinion negatively as well as positively. But essentially what Bush wants is sort of a Nuremberg rally. Is that? That's a clear analogy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Where it's simply the supreme leader, Der Führer, comes and is celebrated by the citizenry, but it's all stage managed, all completely stage managed. That's why the only place he ever gives speeches anymore is at military bases.
You know, it's like those giant celebrations they hold over in North Korea as well. It's that same
there
kind
you
of
go.
Thing. The T-shirts that we're talking about said "Love America." Hate Bush, and then on the back, regime change starts at home. Oh, no. How dare they?
Now, this couple was from Texas, and the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, claimed, and successfully, that the couple's First Amendment rights were, where's my constitution here, because the founding fathers, they knew that there were going to be guys like King George. They were under the rule of King George. That's why they revolted. That's why we had a revolution. So the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law prohibiting, or abridging the freedom of speech of the press or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, which means the couple had their constitutional rights
trumped.
Right.
You know, I used to date this lawyer, Peter.
Yeah.
Who carried a copy of, he had a pocket constitution at all times.
He's ready. Yeah. Jeffrey and Nicole Rank refused directions from event staff and law enforcement to cover up their shirts at a July 4th, 2004 West Virginia rally featuring President Bush. The pair were arrested, detained, and charged with trespassing, but the charges were later dismissed. Now, Brian Ross, who does this ABC investigative deal,
mm-hmm.
The settlement in which the government admitted no wrongdoing came after the disclosure of an allegedly, quote, sensitive presidential advance manual, which laid out the White House's meticulous efforts to protect the president and his public image from dissent. The manual instructs, at a last resort, security should remove the demonstrators from the event. And how did the government turned over a heavily redacted, censored version of the manual to the ACLU. I mean, if it says this stuff in it, what in the hell was redacted?
Yeah,
the first step to keeping demonstrators out of events, the manual tells the president's event staff, is to encourage the Secret Service to, quote, ask the local police department to designate a protest area, preferably not in the view of the event site or the motorcade route. Inside the event space, the manual advises, White House advanced personnel should predispose rally squads that can swarm any protesters at the event and, quote, use their signs and banners as shields between the demonstrators and the main press platform. The rally squads can be made up of local fascists. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I missed that. Same thing, though. And that is, the rally squads can be formed using college young Republican organizations, local athletic teams. This sounds like fascists. And fraternities, sororities.
Republicans suck!
Well, they do.
What is that? I love it.
These squads of college young Republicans, local athletic teams, and fraternity sororities can, quote, lead supportive chants to drown out the protesters. USA, USA,
you know
USA.
What? I would take one of those sorority women. I'd take her down.
The manual is stamped sensitive. Do not copy. Its cover warns readers that, quote, it is a violation of federal law to duplicate or reproduce this manual without permission. It is not to be photocopied or released to anyone outside of the executive office of the president, White House, military office, or United States Secret Service. So you can see what Bushco has turned this this government into. A racket. A total 100%
remember,
racket.
Remember, Peter, we were going to find another word. We need to get out our thesaurus. Okay. Racket.
Racket.
We
like
need
racket.
New words.
Yeah.
Give
yeah.
us new words.
Now, there's a couple more things, but let's see.
I mean, racket works. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. There's lots of stuff. All right. Let me just quickly. There was another man who, Kent, Ohio. That's where Kent State is. Mm-hmm. A Kent resident who was ticketed last week for putting up an impeach Bush sign on what was considered SETI land is facing different charges. Now they're going to charge him with a violation of littering.
They said what a joke.
Yeah, it says no person shall place litter on any public property, and his lawyer, who is Bob Fitrakis, who is a partner of a colleague of
Figer.
No. He's not Harvey Wasserman.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we should explain who Harvey Wasserman is. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Oh, me? Yeah. He's our pal. Google him. Wasserman.
Extremely interesting.
Yeah,
man.
One of the founder. I think he worked for a long time with Greenpeace, and he has Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, a book, and we've interviewed him any number of times. Mm-hmm. But his colleague, attorney Bob Fitrakis, says about the guy who is getting the littering ticket for putting up an impeach Bush sign, says, in this case, all the officer had to do is treat him like they admit they treat mainstream political candidates and just say, hey, remove the sign. But the fact that you would criminalize this case, I think, is an attempt to suppress free speech. Do you think, Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah. One further thing about signs. There's going to be any number of marches in Washington. And here, this is from the group called Answer. You can go to answercoalition.org. And they sent out this mailing. In an unprecedented action, the Answer Coalition today received citations fining the organization $10,000 for the placement of posters announcing the September 15th march in Washington, D.C. The fines come after a campaign led by Fox News calling for the D.C. government to take action against those putting up posters for the September 15th demonstration. They've told us that we have 72 hours to remove every poster or the fines will go into effect. Tens of thousands of dollars in additional fines are expected in the coming days. Bush's Interior Department is threatening similar actions against the group. The September 15th posters are legal and conform to city regulations. We will not allow the government's intimidation tactics to slow our outreach or silence the anti-war movement, which is why I was saying I'm thinking about going to the one to the 15th. Now, some of you may think, whoa, wait a minute now. Maybe with all this, you know, Bush getting legal justification for spying on us and stuff like this, and all you put up a sign and the cops arrest you or you wear a T-shirt and the Secret Service arrest, I better just crawl under.
No.
And well,
don't let it stop you.
That's what it's all about. And, hey, I mean, so far, they're not shooting anybody. I mean, this isn't El Salvador. I mean, so, you know, protesting and being a dissident. And remember, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Thank you.
Jillian, you reminded me.
Take your bandana, by the way, from the pepper spray.
Oh, God, that's not going to happen in those things. No, people don't.
Every single time. Okay.
No, I mean,
when it comes out, just run. Peter taught me how to not get arrested or injured.
When we were in Miami. Yeah. Well, those cops were crazy.
They were nuts.
They just attacked people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there weren't there rubber bullets involved in that one or something.
They were the worst.
They're insane.
When was that? That was 03?
Yeah, I think so.
It was. Mm-hmm. But anyway, should we? All right, let's do this. Hang on the line. What's going on here? Is this? Okay.
Oh.
No, that's not the spot.
Phantom button?
No, that was Republicans suck again.
Okay. All right. We can always hear that again.
Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
So we're from Jacksonville, Florida. There's another band from Jacksonville, Florida, which you guys might have heard of. They're called Lynyrd Skynyrd. You ever heard of them? This is Mr. Jason Todd over here playing the Rebel Flag. Song's called Simple Man.
Well, Mama told me when I was young to sit beside me, my only son, and listen closely to what I say. It'll help you some sunny day. It will. Oh, take your time. Don't live too fast. Troubles will come, and they will pass. You'll find a warm arm, and you'll find love. And don't forget that there is a someone up above. So be a simple kind of man. If you can, get you lost from the rich man's gold. All that you need now is in your soul, and you can do this, oh baby, if you try. All that I want from you, my son, is some peace, satisfied, and be a simple kind of man. If you can. Oh, don't you worry. follow your heart and nothing else. You can do this, oh baby, if you try. All that I want from you, my friends, is some patience.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. Joined by Jalene Jordan. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Did you see this one, Jalene? This is from the New York Times. There's a rash of retirements planned among House Republican, and it's adding to the party's electoral challenges and raising questions about a rush for the exits. And we say, don't let the door hit you in the ass.
Good riddance. Get on out of here.
I wonder when the Democrats get in. We're going to need some stuff like that for them, too.
Hey, who does that song?
I don't know.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. Very punk, very fun.
And there is there's sort of a rap lyrics later on.
Okay.
The chorus is Republicans suck. They suck, suck, suck.
That's all we needed to hear.
Yeah. Here, Frank wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We were talking about the economy and how it's just this racket for the rich. Whenever they make mistakes, they get bailed out. The middle class, the working class, the poor, we just got to fend for ourselves. Yeah. He said, I think more is at play than just greed. I think fear is here as well. I think the wealthy ruling class is afraid of us having any money at all. They want to keep people desperate and with a lack of sufficient resources to affect any change. They're afraid of what the citizens might do with money, like organize behind a cause that would rock the boat. Plus, if the people are desperate, they would be unable to do much to stop their agenda of mass control.
You know what else? I think a lot of Republicans deep down are terrified of what Bush is doing, and I think deep down they're pissed too about the money that Bush is wasting over in Iraq, but they won't admit it because they gotta support their president.
Well, there's not too many of them left. Although
they're a
little bit of an uptick.
The ones who are there,
yeah,
are the ones who are just the worst, in my opinion.
All right.
Sorry, Dad.
He's not listening, is he?
No.
maybe it's, why can't my little mouse work here? Or I can't get anybody on the air. Okay. There you go. Why is that happening?
Feedback.
Feedback? My headphones on too loud? All right. I do. They probably are too loud. All right. We can do it. Here is, whoa, boy, I should have seen this earlier. John is on the road. John, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for waiting.
No problem.
So you've been driving with one hand this whole time?
Well, I actually reached my destination, and I'm just sitting outside my house.
All right. Very good. Here you are. You wanted to talk about the Fed's, not the Feds, but the Fed.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. The Federal Reserve, yeah.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure it out. I mean, because that is a tough question, like where do they get their money from? And I've been calling my accountant. I've been doing research online. I got some books, and basically, I come to the conclusion that what the government wants is for us to keep spending money, because that is what is keeping the machine going. So it's very important that we spend money.
Well, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So
you know what happens is usually it's what, you know, there's always a question when recessions occur. Is it overproduction or is it under consumption? Obviously, they're related, but there's not enough consuming going on. And I mean, that's traditional, but now, hey, this was not about consumption. This was just about, you know, fooling around with the elements of the market and who owned what and you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, their move definitely, you know, makes money easier to get. So, I mean, I think we technically went into recession in year 2000, and it was just, you know, artificially inflated since then by loose lending practices. So, but to answer your question, where do they get their money from? Is they call the printer guy and they have them print another sheet of money.
Crank it out. Hey, we need $40 billion for the market. Crank it out. Well, what's third? When you talk about the market, it's 13,000. 13,000 what?
You mean Dow Jones Industrial Average?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how they come up with that number.
But what does it represent? Everything else, you know, like if you say I've got $100 in my pocket, or so you may got like $100, or you know, I've got you know, everything. The number represents units of something. What's the unit here that's being measured? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not putting this on you, and I'm telling you, I've asked people, and I can't remember a real straight answer. This is, you know, the only good statement that any Bush ever made was this one's dad who talked about voodoo economics, and with apologies to the people that practice that, it's not all evil, it is. I mean, it's insane.
No, the other good thing that a Bush said was when Laura said, "Thanks for being my customer." Dimebag Laura? Remember, she used to sell dime bags in college.
She sold some to him? Come on.
She sold it to everyone.
You're making this up. Let's see. Here is Alex. Alex in Rochester. Hi, Alex. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, good.
I'm calling. I've sort of been listening the past couple of weeks, and I've been wondering what you think of Drew and Mike in the Morning.
They're awesome, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't. I rarely ever hear him.
Okay.
I have
Drew has come around to our side of thinking about this war, and I think that Mike is the same way. I think they. What do you think?
Well, I listen to them every morning on the way to work and at work, and politically they seem a little bit more to the right. And I mean, now
well, anyone's a little more to the right than us. Come on.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that. but. I mean, I don't know anybody that isn't against the war now. But I think in the past, you know, like you said, they have come around.
Yes.
And they definitely...
Well, they're both smart guys.
Extremely, yeah. Extremely.
Drew reads an enormous amount. He even had some guests on that I wound up interviewing. I can't remember who it was, but I was astounded that they did. And, but I'll tell you, I don't, you know, this, I go to bed late and I get up, no, I don't get up late, but I usually miss the morning shows, I'll tell you.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked in Detroit, like when Howard Stern was here, mm-hmm. and, who else? What's this guy? I can't remember him. Went to Chicago.
Our buddy Nuge?
No. No, but yeah, Nuge. When Nuge was doing, I never heard any of those guys. You know, they just once in a while I'd see them.
You weren't missing much. Yeah, but
all right.
They've come around. When
That's
I
good.
Left, remember, I went to Miami for a couple of years. When
That's
I left,
right.
They were right there with him, with the old Busher.
Yeah.
And I came back, and it was a whole other story. And I said, "Hallelujah."
Here's Sean in Washington, Michigan. Sean, where the home of the Octagon House, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's correct.
Yeah.
I, you know, I've been listening to you for a little bit, and you know, a few weeks here and there. And I got to say, I'm not gonna lie to you. I would say I'm more of a moderate Republican.
What does that mean?
You are out of the party,
no,
buddy.
No, what does that mean?
You would say certain views I believe in. I believe in the Republican value, and certain views I'm a Democrat. It really depends. Like, maybe even walking the line would be a better way of putting it. But I've served in the military 12 years. I was a security contractor for 2 years in the Middle East. And I got to say honestly, I think, and I'm not trying to. put you down by any means, but I think some of your opinions, I think sometimes the problem is not just the left, but the right sometimes. They think of us as a nation, but they don't think of the world as a whole. I think sometimes they don't think of the big picture. You know, a lot of our administrations that we've had in the long term have made many mistakes. The Bush administration has made several mistakes. Bush is a moron, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Clinton left his guard down for 8 years. I mean, this has been an ongoing thing for many administrations in the Middle East. We can go back to Carter, for God's sakes. And I think just to say, yes, Bush is an idiot, don't get me wrong. I didn't vote for him. I don't like him. But at the same time, I think overall, this is something that's been going on for 20 years. And to blame one administration and just to blame one party is ridiculous. I'm sorry. I don't like the Democrats as much as some of the Republicans I don't like.
Agreed.
We agree. We generally hold our nose and vote for Democrats. I would not call myself a Democrat. I did not vote for Al Gore in 2000. I certainly didn't vote for Bush. And it was only, I could barely bring myself to vote for Kerry. And I
was so proud of you, though, Peter.
Well,
I mean, just because you did it.
So was my dad.
I know it was very difficult
so
for
was
you.
My dad.
And the only thing I have to say is, like I said, when you use the term fascist and Republican, I think that's very extreme because, you know, I served in Somalia in 93. I've seen what warlords do to people. I've seen what fascism really can do to a nation or to a people. I've seen what communism has done to people in Eastern Europe. And I think when you use the word fascist and Republican, I think that's kind of harsh. And I think sometimes maybe you not so much, but a lot of the left or a lot of the liberals up there just drop the term so openly. And lots of this country, still freedom of speech is still there, because if it wasn't, we would not have this opinion on the radio at this time.
Well, agreed, to be sure. But let me say first off that I often say things. I'm, as Jolene is, a radio personality. So, and this isn't like NPR, like National Public Radio, where we have to be, you know, real decorous. What is it? Decorous. Whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
You know, I can't do it. I don't even know what the word is. What the hell?
There's an entertainment value to it.
Yeah. And it also, I mean, hey, you know, and I'm serious. This is good talking with you, so, and I'm not hanging up either, but it got you to call. But the thing, I can't find this article here that I was reading from.
Well, I think if you go down the laundry list, Peter, a lot of what we're saying, it does kind of border on fascism when you look at the fact that we can be spied at any time or have our phones tapped into at any time. That, to me, is right there with fascism. Wouldn't you agree?
But can I say this, though, at least, too, though? In my opinion, if Clinton, and I'm not just saying Clinton, but if Clinton wouldn't have left his guard down for 8 years, maybe we wouldn't have to go out to the extreme that we've gone to.
Hey, he had things going on. He had a girlfriend. Come on.
Well, here's the thing, too. I don't have any need to support or defend Clinton, and I'm not going to. Overall, U.S. Policy in the Middle East is what has brought us to all of this, and Clinton never made any changes from the first Bush administration. And whether, I mean, they argue all the time: did he let his guard down? Did he do enough? He says he did. Critics say he didn't. Here's what I'm talking about. Here's when I used the word fascist. And that was in this, for one thing, it's pretty weird that there is this secret presidential advance manual that there's nothing about security, but rather how to protect the president from public criticism, to keep demonstrators or people that don't agree with him out of these rallies. And here's what I said. The rally squads, and this is what the presidential manual advises. The rally squads can be formed using, quote, college young Republican organizations, local athletic teams, and fraternities and sororities. And what I was trying to get at was that the mobilization of what they see as these right-wing, sort of popular-based groups, which historically has been where fascists have drawn their support from in Europe and in the United States in the 1930s. So it wasn't, I wasn't just being, you know, extreme. I mean, there was some, you know, something behind it. I'm not calling everybody that disagrees with me a fascist, and I don't think that Bush is a fascist. I think there's a lot of fascistic, as Jolene was saying, a lot
tendencies.
Of tendencies.
Well, one thing I have to say, and of course, Liz, your radio show, so I'll let you go, but overall I have to say is that I think several administrations, I think, have done some really shady dealings, Democrats and Republicans, and I think right now the way technology is, where the Internet is, the way the news media is, I think what he's doing, I'm not saying he's not the first, But there are several administrations that have done some really shady dealings, and you can go back, God forsakes, to FDR. And I think the way times are now with the internet and technologies, that these things are leaking out more and more and more. And I think, unfortunately, though Bush is an idiot, don't get me wrong, I think he's a moron. But at the same time, I think it just makes him look worse than ever because the way the media outlets are and the news agencies are more than ever.
Well, in 14 months or whenever the hell it is, when the, January 2009, listen when I start opening up on the Democrats, all right?
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Sean.
Nice talking to you. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Although, it's not like I think that they're equal offenders. There are aspects of the Republicans and the Democrats that they're co-equal in what they've created in terms of a foreign policy that doesn't work, in terms of the way the United States has operated overseas, on and on, that has contributed to having an economy that is just, you know, totally located in a military-industrial complex. There's not a lot of difference between them all. But, and Bushko, this, it's turned out to be an absolutely a racket. I mean, there's the differences have really been magnified by the nature of the Bush regime. Let's go to Kevin in Plymouth. Kevin, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Jalene, how are you guys?
Hey,
we're great.
Did I say your name right?
You got it.
Okay. First of all, you know, Detroit Rock City and, the Motor City basically go hand in hand, and it's too bad, like, rock and roll didn't start, like, 100 years ago when the audio industry did. And if you guys know anything about bands that were around 100 years ago.
Yeah, man, they were, you know, Scott Joplin and
I got a pen. If you could give me some names of some artists or anything, I'd like to maybe look something up. Like a 100-year-old song that's
Scott Joplin. Write that down.
J-O-P-L-I-N, Scott Joplin. Yeah, but there were...
you could even Google that.
Actually, they were jazz bands. I mean, there was a fusion. I don't know. Geez, now I'm going to have to... Am I right in all this? How did rock and roll develop? Out of ragtime and Dixieland and jazz and gospel and...
Yeah,
kind of merged and became what are they used to, blues. Hello, blues. Yeah, the blues. It really the real predecessor of rock and roll is the blues. Right?
Yeah, I would do a little Google search. Go to google.com and
became rhythm and blues.
You know, put down 100 years ago.
Yeah,
rock and roll.
Or, yeah, put groups or music groups early 20th century.
Detroit,
yeah.
Rock City.
And you got it. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Here is Kevin in Dearborn Heights. Kevin, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
I just want to get your thoughts on the 2008 presidential election candidates and also the way how the media has beaten it to death, and I'll hang up.
Oh, you just about all right. The debates. You know, there was another debate today.
This was what, the Republicans? No, this was the Democrats. This was the Democrats.
Yeah, and I slept through that one too. You know how I always sleep through the debates.
I have to say, I don't.
Kucinich was still the most impressive one.
Yeah, they always say that none of the candidates have or none of the candidates addressed, and they always think, well, I think, what about Kucinich?
Yes, please. Yeah. Why is this guy just a non-candidate to all these people? And how about the straw poll in my... I'm so embarrassed to be from Iowa. I'm so sorry. I just am. And Mitt Romney,
You know what would be...
They're all pathetic.
Here is an election that I would really take notice of. If it would be Dennis Kucinich as the Democratic Party nominee against Ron Paul of the... For the Republican standard bearer. But instead, they're just going to get...
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney versus Hillary.
Yeah.
Which I won't have any problem with that one.
No.
We don't want Mitt.
And, you know, I think the only reason that he stands out is because he's the only one who can speak, first of all.
He is smooth as silk,
that man, when the way he speaks, isn't he? And he has this tone and
it's like
this presence and,
it's sort of like
scary.
A Midwest Rotary meeting, isn't it? Something like that. All due apologies to the Rotarians.
Right, right.
But, they're not the most exciting
people in the
world.
Boring.
All right. Chris and Fred and Jeff and Eric, hang on, please. We'll be back to get your calls. If you'd like to dial in, you might be able to quickly grab a line. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. And first off, let me get the music out of here.
Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, Jolene Jordan is with me. 1 a.m., that's in exactly 1 hour. We're going to be airing a couple of interviews I did. They're actually, what do you call them? Repeats. Isn't that the word for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, repeats.
That would work.
But they're good ones. One is with Ian Williams, who wrote a book on rum.
Really?
Yeah.
Rum?
Rum. And the role it's played in world history, which is just amazing.
It was the intoxication it's created?
No, actually, as
the
a commodity.
Trade, the money?
Yeah. Yeah, it was all about slaves and rum and molasses and sugar cane and you know, slaves to grow the sugar cane. It's in some ways not a very pretty story, but he's also a great fan of rum, which I like rum, too.
Yeah.
I like rum drinks.
I had some rum last night.
Did you?
I did.
Mm-hmm. How much? Never mind.
No, I only had two. Two rums. You would have been proud of me.
Not rum and Coke.
No.
What?
No, I do rum and ginger ale.
Blah.
It's really good.
I'm too hip for the room, so
Mr. Mojito.
I drink mojitos. Yeah. Yeah. And also Jeff Cohn, a Detroiter, an old pal of mine, who wrote a book on cable news. And he had he's worked on Fox News and what have you.
I remember when he was on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, here. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Did you see this, that Medicare is not going to cover hospital errors according to a new Bushko directive?
He is such a sweetie, I tell you. They leave that towel in you or they leave that scalpel in you or something. Too bad. Your problem.
Yeah, you don't get the Medicare won't pay for it. It's something that, they said that they're not going to pay the extra cost of treating preventable errors, injuries, and infections that occur regularly in hospitals.
You know, when is this karma going to kick in?
Oh, man.
When it is so big and bad. Bush has a bad future ahead of them.
They're going to save, $20 million. That's what they say.
Oh, yeah. Well, isn't that good for them?
Medicare says it will not pay for the treatment of serious preventable events, like leaving, as you said, leaving a sponge or other object in a patient during surgery and providing a patient with incompatible blood or blood products. So the hospital screws up, and you've got to pay the cost? This does not. But, you know, it estimates that you want to stay out of hospitals. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that patients develop 1.7 million infections in hospitals each year, and 270 people a day die.
Oh my gosh!
That's amazing.
That really is.
So they're going to save $20 million. Screw people badly.
Yeah.
United States, in the meantime, has sunk to number 42 in life expectancy.
Really?
Here's my challenge again, folks. What is the United States number one in? That's good. It just ain't there.
Not finding much these days.
So, pardon me. In the meantime, so $20 million, a small Carolina parts supplier collected about $20 million over 6 years from the Pentagon for fraudulent shipping costs. So there you go. There's $20 million.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. They shipped like two washers or something.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Here is Jeff. Jeff is in Windsor. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello, Pete. Hello, Julian. Long
Jeff.
Time to know here. All right. United States was number one in overpaying their sports stars and underpaying their teachers.
There you go.
Another one. We did the Woodward Dream Cruise with my nephew Jimmy last night, and I noticed that the Woodward has come a long way from it being like an old dilapidated strip to a It looks like it's actually, you know, building up or improving itself a bit.
Where are you looking?
I agree.
Detroit.
I went from downtown Detroit straight up to 14 Mile.
Well, downtown's looking pretty good, but up around Highland Park, getting a little.
Some areas they have improved.
How far is Highland Park out there?
Davison, like 4 Mile, or so 4 miles from downtown. Yeah,
I found it looking pretty good all the way up to 14 Mile.
That's good.
It is better.
That's good.
And I found some of the churches along Woodward to be pretty old looking. Would you say that they were predating Detroit as a city?
No, Detroit was founded in 1701.
Yeah, some of these churches look even older than that.
No, they're
made of stone.
No, they are. I mean, there's a church. Well, you might have looked at the one on right at West Forest in Woodward.
Yeah, exactly. I remember seeing that one.
I think that's the
picture of that one.
1870s or 1880s, something like that.
Yeah, too, eh?
Yeah.
Well, they They actually look pretty good. That whole area.
You get absolutely no idea that Detroit is this really old city. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years old. I don't think there's any architecture that goes back hardly before the even pre-Civil War. I mean, there was a fire. When was the? Well, you're not from Detroit. You don't have to know. You remember there were fires in the cornfields in Iowa, right? But
I thought you were talking about the riots.
No. I'm talking about the 1800s. Okay. There was a fire, I think, in 1803
fire
or something like that.
In the cornfields.
You know, and right before Halloween when they tie them all up, all those corn stalks and all that, and you're going to move them, sell them, you know, those markets to the city guys. Thank you, Jeff, for making our show international. Thanks for calling 313-298-WR.
That was a positive phone call.
It was. It was indeed.
Nice.
And here I was trying to say, still a little bit. Here's Chris in Ann Arbor. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Hi, Pete and Jolene. How's it going?
Going good.
So to answer your question about the market and that 13,000 number, it's the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
I know. Average
yeah,
of what?
Well, it's an average of like 30 prominent corporations. You know, some of our favorites like
no,
GE
like,
and
what,
Exxon.
Units.
Microsoft.
What are the units?
What's it measuring? 13,000?
The price of the stock. It's 30 companies. It's some sort of index of the price.
You don't know, either.
Well, it's
I know that. I know that it's an average. Dow Jones average. So they take these specific companies and their stock that they think is emblematic of the market at any particular time, and they average it. But then they say, well, the market used to be, like during the 1920s, it used to be 250. So now it went over 14,000, and it's capitalized that much more. But what is it measuring?
Well, yeah, I have no idea.
None of us know.
But
it's
but
okay.
On the Federal Reserve, you know how you asked where it came from, and that caller was exactly right. All they do is just print the money. And what's not very well known, there's a couple things not very well known about the Federal Reserve. You probably know, Pete, but the first one is the Federal Reserve sounds kind of federal, like it's within the government or something, but it's privately owned.
Well, it's a quasi-governmental agency that can set market. It sets the interest rates.
Well, yeah, the president appoints an Alan Greenspan or the name we've been hearing all week, Bernanke or whatever.
Yeah, but you see, among the money nuts and a lot of the right wing, in fact, isn't that the video from Freedom to Fascism that they say 1912 or whenever the hell it came in, and everything was great in America, and then the Federal Reserve came in, and everything went to hell. Well, in 1912, there was immense labor strife. There was the most vicious segregation going on. Women couldn't vote, on and on. Yeah.
Well, another thing about the Federal Reserve is about a year and a half ago, they stopped publicly printing how much money they're printing. So nobody knows how much money they're dumping into
the
economy.
Well, wait a minute. But wait, we're talking the 21st century. They didn't all of a sudden call up the printing presses and say, crank off, how many $1,000 bills would that be? 40 billion. Hey, it's all just cyber cash anyway. I mean, it's voodoo economics. The whole system is just in outer space or something.
I agree. And, the Chinese own the majority of that. I think they got $1 trillion of our dollars.
I don't know. It's not that much. The United States depends on China for its day-to-day operating expenses now that Bushco has driven the United States into debt by its foolish tax policies and its war policies. Yeah.
Yeah, and if they decide to sell those dollars, we're going to see the dollar plunge.
Yeah, they're threatening to do it because the United States has been threatening China. They want China to reevaluate its currency. They say it's overvalued. And whatever the hell that means. You know, people buy currency. Aha.
Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's an absolutely insane international system. It doesn't make a bit of sense.
Peter George has a wedding to pay for now, okay?
Yeah.
He has to, he's going to up the racket to heights unknown because there's going to be a White House wedding.
Yeah, the little party girl settling down, huh?
Yeah, I always kind of liked the Bush twins, especially that one because she was wild. I thought, I was really hoping that she would be like me where I would be the one breakout of my Republican family. Like, I would be the sanity, she would be the sanity. There would be, What was I thinking? There's no sanity. She's marrying a guy who was an assistant to Rumsfeld, I believe, Ashcroft.
Some Republican hack.
Ashcroft. I mean.
Right. Well, here, China.
Hopeless.
China, as I hope everybody realizes, that part of what your taxes are going for now, and if you're 15 years old or 16 years old, like I know a portion of you are that are listening to the show, unless things change dramatically, by the time you're in your 60s, you're still going to be paying off debt service on these loans that Bush has taken out with these Chinese banks. And we talk about who are potential opponents. Well, Russia and China have been holding joint war games. That's right. They're pals again, you know. Fighter jets streaked through the air as Russian and Chinese forces held their first joint maneuvers on Russian land Friday in a demonstration of their growing military ties and a shared desire to counter U.S. global clout. The war games in the southern Ural Mountains involved troops from China and Russia with a handful of soldiers from four ex-Soviet Central Asian nations that are part of the... Remember this group, because you're going to be hearing a lot about it. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the CSO. And that's going to arise as the rival, both militarily and economically, probably already has, in our lifetime. United States Russia. Let's get into the 21st century. Russia is placing strategic bombers back on long-range patrol for the first time since the Soviet breakup, sending a tough message to the United States on Friday, hours after a major Russian military exercise with China. Well, why are these people being so terrible? Well, the United States is beginning once again to ring the Soviet Union with missile defense systems. Now, there's treaties that oppose this because these shields are part of an offensive system. Like if you and I have a sword, we could be equally matched. But if suddenly I get a shield, who's got the advantage? And this is what Putin and the Chinese see, that the United States is ramping up. The United States, not Russia and not China. They are completely into international cooperation. They're big powers and they have economic interests of their own. Yeah. And they probably see this stumbling giant that Bush has turned the U.S. into and see that there's a possibility of advantage. But they never made any military moves. The United States, I think the Chinese, given how big the country is, they spend $50 billion a year. $50 billion a year. On military. United States spends $500 billion. I mean, who's the warmongers here?
Yeah.
Who has a system that is rooted in a military-industrial complex when we have a situation where we have foreclosures that are growing every week?
Day.
Day. Yeah. Where we have 47,000 people in the homes in Detroit that have had their water shut off and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to correct myself on the Jenna Bush. He was Karl Rove's assistant.
Oh, man.
Even worse.
Yeah, that's worse. Yeah.
Back to more serious issues.
Well, but here you go. They're going down the route, too. I stand corrected as well. A 7-year, $200 billion rearmament plan signed by President Vladimir Putin earlier this year will purchase new generations of missiles, planes, and perhaps aircraft carriers to rebuild Russia's arsenal.
Well, and I don't think he would have done any of this before.
No. I mean, this is all Bush is doing.
I mean, as you always said, the Soviet Union is not a threat.
No, because they don't exist.
Right.
I keep calling it the Soviet Union.
I know.
So, yeah. All right, here is Fred.
You got me, Peter.
Fred's in Detroit. Hi, Fred. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys.
Hey.
Hi. I think the word you were searching for a little while ago is decorum.
Decorum, yeah. Decorous,
right.
Though. No, the word is decorous.
But, oh, okay.
You show decorum by being decorous.
Oh, okay.
You're absolutely right, Fred.
I'll take your word for that.
Okay.
Well, next, concerning poor old Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
Remember, Jolene, the United States media is about a cult personality, and he's not exactly Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, just like Meryl Streep doesn't get near about the amount of press that a Paris Hilton would. So
that's a good point. Excellent
point. So much
point.
For that.
And Kucinich doesn't have any money either.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think he's
doesn't have flair or money.
I don't know. You could go to his site. He might have it. But I think he has raised about $1 million, and Hillary has already spent like $25 million, or I don't know, or raised that much. But It's big bucks.
Now, getting over to Drew and Mike.
Yeah.
I will say that there are times when Drew is annoying, for instance, when he defends Bush, as if Bush needs to be someone who has to be coddled.
Hmm.
And
still,
you tend to get excuses, you know, for Bush's missteps out of the guy. And then you get Mike. He likes to knock single-payer health. And I believe I told you guys, you know, a few weeks ago, hey, the lame argument is always that we have the best health care system and technology in the world.
Yeah.
If we went to single-payer, I mean, are these doctors and these machines, are they going to suddenly dry up and go blow away?
Yeah, guys like them, they could still hire their own doctor. They could buy a hospital.
Well, I just hate to hear certain radio personalities who are really, really, really thinking only of themselves and prepared to knock anything else.
I hear you. They shouldn't be doing it.
And I think the Dow is the value of the given stocks in, you know, during the trading session.
Yeah.
If they're trading high, the number is up.
Well, yeah.
If they're selling at a very low price, then the number's in a dumpster.
Go down.
What are the units?
Fred,
what does a unit consist of?
You're saying that perhaps that it's the Dow Jones average could be the combination of the value of the 30 stocks that they're averaging?
Right. All shares in circulation. That's the way I think it works.
I don't know, man. You know, think about this. I mean, stocks, if they're doing well, they're like $60 a
right.
stock or something like that. So that's, you're not going to add up to $13,000. And if it...
Oh, no, but the $13,000 is something like in terms of millions or billions.
Oh, I mean, like, so, yeah, they'll say...
Yeah, like 13,000 billion.
Right, so, they'll say 13,000 in billions. Well, I've never seen it. You could be right, Fred. Hey, thank you very much.
All right.
Appreciate your call, although I don't think that's it. So what we're talking about here, people, there is something, you always say the Dow is over 14,000, it dropped below 13,000, it finished after the infusion of cash from the Fed. Over 13,000. 13,000 what? Come on. There's thousands, tens of thousands of you. Wait a minute. You know what we haven't looked at? We have not looked at the email. That's where a lot of times people, oh, my God. They got...
I think you should take a phone call and check this during the commercial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, are we on the air?
We are.
Okay.
Live,
wait a minute here. Wait a minute. Here, this is Roderick. I found a definition of what the Dow Jones Industrial Average means. It's a mess, but I'll try to come up with a simplified definition within 15 minutes or so for you. Rod wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right. Let me see. One more. Oh, and I was saying, I didn't think that there was anything that the United States was number one in that was good, and that's how far we've been driven down. Number one is number one in basketball and shooting guns.
All right. Guns, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
But we mean really something good.
Yeah. Well, basketball's good.
Oh, yeah.
But,
sure. But, I mean, let's talk about good, you know?
Yeah, I mean, important.
To humankind.
Yes, important social indexes.
The environment
or
animals or...
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Here is Eric. Hi, Eric. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Well, you are close by, but go ahead.
Well, it's funny that you just said a little while ago something about checking the email, because I was wondering what you guys thought about a guy who's a complete liar and gets amnesia when he gets on the stand, deciding it's okay to wiretap anyone he wants and check anyone's computer whenever he feels like it to make sure we're not up to the same kind of things that he is.
Oh, as in Bush?
Or as in Alberto Gonzalez?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well,
yeah, he's a criminal.
Let me tell you this. There was what they call an op-ed piece in the New York Times today where, the New York Times gave him space to do this, calling for the impeachment of Gonzalez. And the Times, in its main editorial policy, has hinted at it. Yeah, this guy has violated numerous statutes, criminal statutes, advocated torture, has tried to turn the Justice Department into a little fiefdom of the Republican Party, and done. I mean, how many other things?
Republicans suck.
Okay. All right. So, what do we do?
What's the latest now? I read, what was this about? They're trying to, including they, Bush administration and Gonzalez trying to speed up executions of criminals.
Yeah.
Did you read that
one? See that, Eric?
Oh, is that the why he's wiretapping people to know who to execute quickest?
Yeah. There you go. There's a theory.
No, it's incredible. Under I think it's under the Patriot Act that they can circumvent the appeals courts, and they appeal to the attorney general, who is Alberto Gonzalez. Isn't that sweet? Here's this guy that is corrupt to the hilt, has lied to Congress forever, every time he gets on the stand, and advocated and told Bush that torture was all right under international conventions.
Yeah.
And now he, well, of course, he was Bush's advisor in Texas.
Yes.
And we know
he's a lifer.
That there's dozens and dozens, I forgot what the figure is, getting close to 200 people that have been exonerated that were on death row.
From DNA, right?
Yeah. And last year, there were something like 56 people executed.
52 Americans executed last year. Thousands await their fate.
Thousands!
U.S. is already among the top six countries worldwide in terms of the numbers of putting its own citizens to death.
See, we're not number one. Again, we're not number one.
I mean, geez. You know, and you look at, people talk about torture in other countries and how they, you know, kill their citizens for, you know, whatever. We're doing the same damn thing. We just have a different method.
Well, it's only 56. China.
And here we go saying we again.
Yeah. China executed 1,000 people.
Really?
Yeah. So they're number one. Number one.
Number one.
Number one.
We want to be number one.
And so there are some whack jobs out there that think there's thousands of people on death row. Let's put them all to death.
Yeah, just fry them.
Could you? Well, why don't they? They got too many. Maybe they could put them all, like, how about a, you know, they used to.
A mass firing?
That'd be squad, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be a little weird. How about.
Well, of course, it would be weird. I'm thinking like the Bush administration.
Like California.
No.
California. They used to have execution by gas chamber. You can make these huge gas chambers.
Oh.
And then put them on railroad cars from all over the country.
Wait.
And
oh.
Put them in there and gas them all.
That sounds.
That'd be efficient.
Familiar.
Whew.
Yeah.
Wow. How we? Oh, yeah. We got lots of time. 313-298-WRIF.
God bless America.
313-298-9743. Welcome to the show. I'm sorry, I don't see your name up here or where you're calling from, but you're on the air. Who's this?
Jonathan from Warren.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, just about what you guys were talking about, like with the presidential candidates earlier. One of the things that I want to bring up is, I don't know if any of you have heard this, but there's actually a site. It's called Unity 08.
Unity LA?
08.
Oh, 08. Okay.
It's just, yeah, it's just a huge site. Like, they got a bunch of stuff, and they've been going around getting, like, people who are completely fed up with how our government is right now. And it's just a way of getting, like, people to, like, get their voices out. And they've been trying, they're, like, setting up for a whole thing. I don't have this, I'm not at the site right now, I'm not even at my computer, but it's just a whole thing about, like, who you'd want for president, trying to get a bunch of people to agree on one, and, or even to get their own person up there on the ticket for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unity08.com, is it?
We'll check it out.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mark writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He's listening in Columbus, Michigan, and he says the U.S. is U.S. number one. The U.S. is the largest charitable giver. I'm not quite sure what charitable giver means.
Would that be through the churches? Or?
Or it could mean people often think that we give this extraordinary amount of money to other countries. But really about, like, for instance, the United States now has signed a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Israel for the provision of $30 billion in U.S. military aid to Israel over the next 10 years. This is a 25% increase over the current U.S. annual military aid appropriation to Israel.
They call it aid, but it's more of here you go,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so this is where your tax dollars are going, folks. Your $30 billion is going to Israel. So what do they do when they buy all these weapons? Part of it is they buy weapons back from us. We give them, it's such a scam. We give them money, mm-hmm. and then they buy these weapons, and then they, you know, they use these fighter jets to attack urban areas like they used it for the attacks on Lebanon, where they killed 1,000 people and destroyed the infrastructure of Lebanon.
Well, and Palestine.
And, folks, you guys, what do I mean you guys? We, you and me, the average taxpayer, we paid for all this, $30 billion. What else could we do with $30 billion? And you say, now, wait a minute, man, if we give $30 billion to Israel, it's going to piss off these Arab countries, so we better give Israel, we better give these Arab countries some money, too.
Right.
So we're giving them tens of billions of dollars, Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, anybody that goes for the plan.
You know what my question is to the listeners is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Because it's not okay with me. It's not okay with us.
Yeah. And also, in terms of Israel making peace with the Palestinians, mm-hmm. which it has no interest in doing whatsoever, all the United States would have to do is say, look, we want a two-state solution, if that's what the United States wants. I don't want... Figure it out by Sunday, next Sunday, or no more money. And
can you imagine?
It would be done in a second. All right. All right, let's go back to the appropriate screen and pick up Tina. Tina's in Port Huron. Hi, Tina. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question about some unemployment issues that my family currently is experiencing. My husband lost his job in September, and he filed for extension sometime in April, and he had an appeal twice. And then go to court, and he was ordered to get the extension, court ordered to get the extension, and the unemployment office is denying him that after it was court ordered.
Uh-huh.
And my question is when there is a court order, doesn't the unemployment have to follow that?
You would think so. Why aren't they?
I have no idea, but I know that my husband has to go back to court this Tuesday for a second appeal in front of the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally got a job in June, but now he has to miss work to go for this, which they're supposed to be giving him retro. While with the way that the unemployment is here, you think they would be happy to give him the few months that they need or they owe him.
Well, how many weeks do you get unemployment now? How long?
You get, I believe that it was 26 weeks unemployment,
mm-hmm.
and you get $362 a week, which he was a plant manager, so he was getting way over that, but the company was bought out by a company overseas, so everything was shipped overseas.
Great.
And he, you know, lost his job. We have a family of four. I'm trying to go to school for nursing, you know, for my family. And, of course, no one would help me pay for my school. I had to pay for it myself with my savings, you know.
Yeah.
And then unemployment doesn't want to give what I feel is owed to him. He's worked every possible day in his life that he could, sick or well, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I'll tell you, it's always been at that level, but it used to be like a generation ago, 30 years ago or so, that during the recessions that happened during the 1970s, the state of Michigan paid unemployment to people up to 65 weeks. That's like a year and a quarter. Because they knew the good old days, they were, because there was sure a lot of things wrong then also.
Mm-hmm.
But now the state is so strapped. The country is in debt. Jobs are going overseas, as you experienced in your own family, Tina. And now, rather than having a system that would allow for free tuition for people like yourself, and, I mean, if I said to you that high school, not to you, but if I said to people in the audience that, well, we ought to have families pay for high school, people would think I'd lost my mind. Well, why all of a sudden is there free public education up till high school? Why isn't college free as well? Well, now, of course, the United States cannot afford it. And why can't the wealthiest country in the world afford it? Because there are certain priorities. And the priority is the military-industrial complex rather than the people of the United States. Is that clear?
And good luck to your husband on Tuesday.
Yes, Tina.
Fight the good fight.
Yes. Email us. Let us know what happened. All right. We got to go to a break. Thank you. And as Jolene said, the best of luck to you. Peter Werby, Jolene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
We're looking out there.
The pictures. The podcast.
The blog.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else.
Super freaking cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
W-R-I-F.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and this is our last segment, but we got quite a bit of time, right up till 1 a.m., then I'll have a couple of, did I miss a pronoun there? Wheel aisle? Something like that. We'll have a couple of recorded interviews, one with Ian Williams talking about rum, and also Jeff Cohen talking about cable news. Both of them interesting, I think. Oh, yeah, a couple of emails here. Let's see. Actually, I'm not having a lot of luck reading this one quickly. It's from Gloria. Is she? Oh, you want your mic on?
Hello.
Oh. Yeah, hi, Jolene Jordan. Because it should. Maybe that was a Freudian sleep, actually. Slip. And because she addresses it, this is what I wanted to. Dear Jolene, and then in parentheses, and Pedro.
Nice.
Yeah, and so
I'm never first.
Yeah, you were that time.
Yeah,
and you were talking about that we should get another name
for racket.
For racket.
Yes.
And James, listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, says could be called the Bush Death Machine.
That's a good one. Yeah.
That's
The Death Machine.
Yeah, Mike Malloy, my national colleague, he calls it the Bush crime family.
Yeah.
That's the absolute best.
That is.
Yeah, but a Bush one. Death Machine, anyway.
It's true.
He said, be the death of our civil liberties or an economic death by a thousand cuts or death via DU poisoning, which is depleted uranium.
Oh, death of the middle class.
Or death rain from above wrapped in a 2,000-pound bomb. It's all the consummate death machine. Yet our world imploding. Alberto Gonzalez finds time for this. The New York Times reports that the Justice Department may begin using one of the rarely noted provisions. Oh, this one. One that gives the Attorney General the power to shorten the time period within which state death row inmates can file federal appeals of their
Get
death
this
sentence.
Guy out of here.
Yeah.
Excuse me to holler.
He says
like that.
He's an old goat of 52. I'm counting down the days to the Rage Against the Machine concert at Alpine Valley over here in Wisconsin. My night of cathartic raging against the Bush death machine.
I wish I could come there and rage with you.
Yeah.
Anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, Rage Against the Machine is a band. They broke up. They're back together. They're highly political.
Right.
And, they're one of my favorite bands that we play.
Who did we see in Miami at that?
We saw Tom Morello.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
he is part of that, and he also has a band called The Night Watchman, and he's very, very, very into the movement, just as we are.
Yep.
Progressive movement.
Here is Jason Ypsilanti. Jason, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Boy, you really covered so many things tonight. I kind of wanted to at least get a couple things in. But
all right, but let's start with this. Where does the name Ypsilanti come from?
I happen to know it comes from General Demetrius Ypsilanti, who led the Greek resistance against the Turks in the 1820s when Ypsilanti was founded. It was very popular, and that's
there
why
you go.
The name.
Peter.
Yeah, everybody thinks it's a like an Indian name or something.
Yeah, that's true. That's
very
Greek,
impressive.
Greek general. We're impressed. Let's.
Was really impressive.
Yeah.
Ready to go on Jeopardy, right?
All right. Yeah. How would you pose that? Who is? Yeah.
Well, my vote for what America is still number one in is rock and roll. I think we still got that spot.
Hey.
There
all
you go.
Right.
There you
all
go.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important. A lot of the Lollapalooza festival has been going on, the Warped tour. What else?
Ozfest.
Yeah.
We have Project Revolution coming up this week with Linkin Park.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Okay. That's good.
On the Dow Jones thing, that is the weight of the 30 averages, but it's calculated, so it's weighted differently. They do it a lot more complex than they used to, so it comes out to be a bigger number. I won't explain it all, but that's what it is.
No, well, that doesn't do a bit
of good.
What
are the units? Yeah. What do they represent?
They add up the value of one share of stock, I believe.
It's shells. I'm going back.
If you look, it's all
it's a shell gain. It makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. The basic point I wanted to make. There's so many, but I'll just make this one. You had a call earlier who talked about, you know, basically saying, you know, I know Bush is bad, but the Democrats are bad too, and I agree to some point, but I'm kind of tired of that defense because it's an excuse for not doing anything.
Right.
And the thing is, back when we originally had the first oil crisis and a lot of things were going wrong, and not to say the world was perfect, but when Carter was in, he did try and push us towards alternative energy and conservation and stuff, but that's when Reagan came in and everyone was so happy that the oil crisis and stagflation was over, they believed all Reagan's lies. People forget that. People were really scared about, you know, oil going away or being less of it. And
you know what the first thing that Reagan did, the very first thing that Reagan did when he entered the White House on January 20th, 1981? He took the solar panels off the White House roof,
And that was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And I just think it's impossible. They make it impossible for the Democrats or anybody, Green Party, to. You couldn't fix it all right away, and the first thing you have to do is be able to talk about the truth. And that's the main thing that Karl Rove and the Republicans do is scare people and make things too complicated for them or try to and confuse them so that we cannot have an honest discussion about things like you guys are doing tonight, which is why you're so great.
Well, thank you. But, you know, the thing about Democrats and the people about that that have ideals, I think, on the left are highly ethically motivated. And when anyone shows hypocrisy or, you know, that doesn't follow through completely on what they aspire to, we're pretty quick to withdraw our support, where you got to have like a losing war before these right wingers will even. And think of that. I mean, 30% of people still support Bush.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And
I heard his numbers tweaked up a little bit to like 32.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. Yeah. So, how many more exposés do you have to have of Bush? How many of these hypocritical Republicans, just three more sex scandals of the Republicans? Like, the head of the Michigan Young Republicans was, I think, pled guilty to Maven rape, something like that.
That's true.
Was it right?
Really?
And then I can't even remember the other two.
It happened in Cleveland, but it wasn't ahead of the Michigan Republicans. They were on some kind of convention. I remember that was on a Raw story, I think.
Yeah. And there was, if you had 500 stories of sexual misconduct, particularly, I mean, and who's
in
using
the Catholic Church?
No.
Outside?
No, outside. Just 500 involving political people. 496 of them would be Republican. I mean, really?
Yeah.
It's kind of like how Republicans are the only ones who don't clean up their dog poop according to Peter.
I would believe that, too.
They don't.
That's Peter's theory.
Yeah. You know, I have actually little flags that have Bush's photograph on them. They're little paper flags, about 2 inches long and inch and a half. On a little stick. When I find dog poop in our local park, I stick this flag on it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I got a lot of time on my hands. All right. Thanks a lot.
You're doing good things with it.
I appreciate your call.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Actually, here, let me see if I can get to, where is he now? Oh, I can't find this. So this is the guy that runs that website.
Oh, yeah, you have been emailing him a little bit.
Yeah, he was going to be on this national show I was doing. And, I guess, hey, we got people waiting. Yeah. Let's get back to our phones. Here's our next call. What is anything? Here's Eric in Monroe, the home of Fermi 2 and General George Custer. You're on the air.
So we are more than you are best.
Oh, turn down your radio.
This is, I could tell. Where this is. It says, what's he want to talk about? Anything, it says. So he's there. Here's Will. Will is in Windsor.
Abroad.
Go ahead, Will. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I didn't get the first part of the show, but I just wanted to respond to one of your emailers was asking earlier the percentage of America's gross national product that's given out in foreign aid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's point one for the year 2005. It was 0.17%.
Oh.
So it's just a little over one-tenth of 1%.
Jeez.
That was given out in foreign aid, and 40% of that amount was in the form of military aid, primarily to Colombia, Israel, and Egypt.
There you go.
And,
that's a nice destinations for our money.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if they ever put that up to a referendum, I wonder how many people would say, yeah, that's okay. That's okay. We like to do that. Go ahead.
The fun thing was, though, is that when I was reading this just in a book called Nemesis by Chalmers Johnson, and one of the interesting things was is when they did this, it was actually in response to a poll where they polled the American people as to what they thought the American government gave out in terms of financial aid, which was part of their national wealth. And most people believed it was between 20 and 28% total wealth.
And Americans routinely believe that this is all given to people in what that one emailer said, in a charitable sense, is that they're given to help them economically.
Yeah.
A lot of it is to do economic aid to American corporations functioning overseas.
Yeah, and then they're polluting the water and poisoning
But America stands 16th out of 17 of the richest countries, Italy being the only one that gives less. But also, when you were mentioning earlier, you're asking about how much debt China owns of the American debt.
Right.
It's actually $850 billion, and Japan just noses them out at just over $900 billion.
So we're almost $2 trillion
Asian
banks.
To those two nations. So
that's
why we have such leverage now.
So you were right. Did you say $1 trillion?
It's close to
Darlene? Well, you were a lot closer to it than I was.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, and I know this sounds petty, and it probably, but I'm going to just bring it up.
You're going to talk about my grammar?
No.
No, okay.
It's always bothered me, and I just wanted to wonder if anyone else ever noticed this, but don't you think, has anybody noticed Karl Rove looks a lot like Heinrich Himmler?
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
I don't have a picture of Heinrich Himmler.
You ever look in your history book? Seriously,
well, maybe we'll go to
we'll, close look.
All right. We'll Google.
This okay. was the, what was he? Was the,
he was the head of the SS.
Oh, yeah, right. That's
they
sweet.
They really do look a lot alike.
Wow. I've seen pictures separated of him falling birth. Asleep to the History Channel before.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Now, let's see. Ed from East Point. Now, he, I think, has explained what the Dow Jones average is, but you know what? It's not going to do as much good. The Dow, he wrote in and wrote, the Dow Jones is a weighted average. Someone else used that as well. Stock A might have a price of $20 and have 10 million shares outstanding, and stock B might have a price of $20 and have 20 million shares outstanding. Stock A would contribute 200 points to the average, and stock B 400 on the average. All 30 stocks then add up to 13,000. Yeah.
I'm
but
sorry.
Thank you.
Not that you bored me. I just, it all, numbers, my head goes to mush.
But think about that. That's not a bad price for stock. I mean, some stocks are, yeah, $20 is pretty good. But so that's.
You're a big stock market player, Peter?
Me. I have a pitiful little 401k. I have no idea what's going on. I just keep it conservative. So when in terms of investing, the only thing conservative I do. Actually, everything in my life is my personal. Everything in my personal life is very conservative, isn't it?
As in you probably conserve water.
No, I don't.
Oh.
There's no need to conserve water. We live in the Great Lakes.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we can just open, let the faucets run, which is nice for me to say at a time when 47,000 families in Detroit
have
their
no water,
cut off.
And when water could be the biggest crisis in our future.
Well, here's Rod was going to get back to, oh, man. Well, the stocks are the 30 largest and most widely owned stocks of public companies. These prices of these stocks, what they're currently worth, and the street as well, it's the number given on.
Are we live? Is this on?
No, yeah, I can't figure it, Rod. All right, if you want to grab some, we've got some open lines right at the end of the show here, and probably can get you on if you'd like to call 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. How about if we do this, Jillian? From now on, since I can remember 313-298-WRIF, you can give the other part of it.
Oh, that would be just so sweet.
What is it?
It's 9743.
313-298-9743. There you go.
How's that?
That's good. That's excellent. Here's Aaron. Aaron, where are you calling from?
I'm actually in Sterling Heights right now, but I live in Royal Oak.
Well, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Aaron.
I just wanted to call and say something about my tax dollars and where it's going and how a lot of times it's going to send troops overseas and to Iraq and everything.
Yeah.
And I would rather see it go towards schools here in the United States and help people in poverty and who can barely pay for their bills and are getting kicked out of their houses and rebuild schools so kids can have books and learn and be able to get good jobs, because I know here in Michigan the economy sucks and a lot of people aren't able to get good jobs, and if they could higher their education, because I know a lot of people don't really have the money to. My best friend, she's not going to be able to go to college right now. She's going to have to put it off a while because she has no money.
Yeah.
And
well, Aaron, think about this. I said earlier that college ought to be free for everyone, and I suspect, tell me if you're wrong, but probably that wasn't ever a thought that you ever occurred to you, because most people think that you have to pay for college just the way you have to pay for groceries. But why shouldn't education be free? It's free.
I think it should be. I totally agree with that. I think learning should be free. You shouldn't have to pay to learn something new. If you want to learn, you shouldn't have to pay for it. I totally agree that college should be free.
But
Aaron is such a voice of sanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll never get anywhere.
Like us.
All right. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for calling. We're going to take calls pretty quickly. Here's Jim in Dearborn. Jim, hi. It's Peter and Jillian. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julian.
Hi.
I just wondered, I wasn't able to listen the last couple of weeks very much, but have you folks talked about this video that surfaced from 1994, an interview with Dick Cheney, in which he, it's a 3 or 4 minute video in which he gives very solid reasons for not going into Iraq? Are you familiar with this video?
Well, not going into Iraq, but he says that why, when he was a Secretary of Defense under the first George Bush, why they didn't drive on to Baghdad and remove Saddam Hussein for power. He said we would have been stuck in a quagmire.
Right.
Yeah. Actually,
where we are now.
Yeah. It's the video is incredible. It's on my website. You can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Let me see. I can just quickly... Here, this is from 1994. It's available on YouTube. And the questioner says, do you think the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad? No, says Dick Cheney in 1994. Why not? Dick Cheney says, because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anyone else with us. There would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. And once you got to Iraq and took it over, took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? It's a very volatile part of the world, says Dick Cheney. And if you take down the central government of Iraq, you could very easily end up seeing prices, pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it, the Syrians would like to have part of the West, and then he goes on and on and on.
He needs to take a look at himself and see that again.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to talk about the casualties.
Oh, yeah. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact we were able to do our job in 1991 with as few casualties as we had, which was, what, like 194?
Do you think he really cared? Nah. He doesn't care. He has not one warm, good feeling in his body.
Yeah, I just couldn't figure out why the Democrats and the media haven't blared this video across the from every rooftop. But it gives very solid reasons for not going into Iraq. I know like you say it was in the context of the Gulf War, but still the facts are the same.
Well, they wanted to leave Saddam Hussein in power because they did not want Iraq splitting apart into a Shiite south and a Kurdish north, and that would involve Syria and Turkey and Iran and Saudi Arabia and all of the Bush One team, Poppy Bush's team, knew that they had to depend on Saddam Hussein to maintain the territorial integrity of Iraq. So I don't know what the hell could have got into him. I mean, he was, of course, one of the guys that put out the biggest lies about the weapons of mass destruction. And I think just even recently, didn't he kept talking about that there was a contact between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which was exposed as total fabrication.
Right. Get him out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Folks.
Appreciate
it. Yeah, it's a reminder
for me
to watch that. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, no, it's astounding. Let's see. Here is Bob. Bob's in Warren. Hi, Bob. You're one of our last callers. We might get a couple more people in if people want to dial up. 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Pete.
Hi.
Good morning. I called to talk to you about presidential elections and why I think they should be eliminated.
Well, they might be. Go ahead.
Presidential elections are worse than high school popularity contests.
Yeah, you're right.
At least in a high school popularity contest, you at least have half a chance of knowing who you're judging.
There you go.
With a presidential campaign, there's absolutely no useful information out there for the voter to vote his or her vote on.
Yep.
Well, they're trying to start earlier.
And almost all the information you get is paid for by the people who are paying for the president's campaign,
right,
or the candidate's campaign. And so I think the whole thing is a mess, and it should be scrapped. Now, the alternative that I'm offering is that presidents will be pretty much selected the way popes are. And the way it would work is at the end of a presidential term, Congress would get together, and here are the rules. In order to win the White House, you have to win the majority of the Senate and the majority of the House,
mm-hmm,
both.
But wait a minute, wait a minute.
What about the people?
What about one party gets in, you're through. The other party's through forever.
That's interesting.
Bob, we're out of time, though. So thanks for that. Let me see, 53. What do we got? How many spots here? 1, 2, 3, 4. Only. Why does it look like so much more than that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't know. All right. Well, instead of counting, how to get somebody on the air. Real quickly, Jesse calling from Troy. You got about a minute. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on voting for a third party? I know it hasn't worked in the past.
I've done it, and given the way politics, the way Bob was just describing accurately, is that long as it's fueled by tens of millions of dollars of... someone else just wanted to talk about chance of third party as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting all these interesting calls. Maybe, what the hell, let's stay on for a couple more hours. As long as big money fuels the elections and it's always corporate money and elite money, they're never going to have a chance. And it's sort of you're blackmailed into voting for the lesser of the two evils of the two parties. All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. And big apologies. Man, would I like to hear what the rest of you like to say. Theo wanted to talk about college tuition and type of rum.
Oh, nice.
Leland had an opinion on Dow
the
Jones.
The tuition makes you want to drink.
Yeah. And Joe's left as well. So, sorry, folks.
How about email? Why don't you email us, or call us back next week.
Yeah. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Stay tuned for the interviews. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Thank you, Jillian.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Jerry.
I'll suppose I'll let this go and find a
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. You probably have heard that from pirate movies or something. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. And sometimes when we're kicking back in the summer, people are having rum and Coke or kind of those Hawaiian drinks or something like that. So rum, like most booze, is just thought of as that, something, a spirit that we use to, facilitate social gatherings or just to enjoy it. If I told you that I have a book in my hand called Rum and the experience of rum in the world, particularly a few hundred years ago, was very comparable to the role that oil plays today, I'll bet you that would surprise you. Well, it surprised me. The book is called Rum, A Social and Sociable History. It's written by Ian Williams. And Ian Williams, who is our guest now in New York City, is the Nation Magazine's UN correspondent. He's the author of Deserter, George Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Own Past, The UN for Beginners. Welcome, Ian Williams.
Good to be here, Peter, even if I can't have a bottle in my hand as I speak.
Well, that's what I was worrying about. It says here, too, since becoming interested in rum, he has amassed a collection of rumabilia, including books, pamphlets, prints, advertising ephemera, bottles, decanters, hundreds of rum labels from all over the world, and a growing collection of rum. I mean, you got to watch this stuff.
Well, it's a bit like having a stamp collection, because you've got a lot of penny blacks and expensive old stamps, it doesn't mean to say you put them on the Christmas cards you send to your granny. So, I mean, I have a lot of this rum, and it's only occasionally that I actually sample. I have over 250 bottles in my cellar, and some of them, I sample them, but, if it's your last bottle of Kazakh rum, you don't really want to gurgle it all down in one.
Well, tell us a little. Let's start off with just the spirit itself. I asked a couple of people if they knew what it was distilled from, and the two people I asked did not. Tell us just a little about the substance itself, the spirit, and what we're talking about here.
Well, the American and the European Union definition of rum is any spirit distilled from sugarcane or its derivatives. And the fun thing about that, of course, is that technically that means in Brazil they run their cars on rum because they use gasohol made from sugar. A sugar cane. And if you've ever drunk some of the nastier types of Brazilian cachaça, which is their local rum, you can see why they'd rather put it in their gas tanks. It's pretty strong stuff. But most of the rums that we drink are made from the molasses, the old blackstrap molasses, which is what's left over when the white sugar has been refined out of the sugar cane juice. The French, being a little snobbish, and a few of other countries, actually make the rum from the full sugarcane juice. And the French very snottily call this rum agricole to distinguish it from the rum industriel that those lesser breeds make. But there's a huge variety of stuff that's drunk hot from the still in sort of parts of Haiti to things like the Zacapa Guatemalan 23-year-old, which is aged for 23 years in the 15,000 feet up in the mountains, so it takes longer to mature. And those finer rums are really like a single malt scotch or a fine cognac. And on the other stand, you've got the pure rot gut that's just good for sort of getting you blotto when the weather's cold and life is too hard.
Now, that brings us a little more to the social history that you write about, Ian Williams, in your book, Rum. And as I said, looking through it and getting ready to read it and reading selected sections of it, the social history of it is extraordinary. Bring us back 250, 300 years. And it wasn't just something for drinking rum and Coke with at a party, was it? It had an incredible social presence.
Well, this was the cheapest form of alcohol that was possible. You have to remember that whiskey is made from grain. And for most of the 17th and 18th centuries, grain was in short supply. So if you use grain to make whiskey, this meant that you were actually sort of diminishing the food supply. And the way things worked in the 17th and 18th century in the English-speaking world is if bread prices went up, then so did the Lord Mayor's house when the mob burnt it and tried to lynch him. So they often actually made distilling whiskey illegal. But with rum, here you have a waste product, molasses. That's what's left over after you've got the sugar out. And 1 gallon of molasses makes a gallon of rum. And people, this was sort of, it was a bit like the first experience of crack cocaine. Some people went mad with it because it was Here it was, readily available, dirt cheap, very potent because they distilled it to very high strengths, and, you know, not to always to high quality either. And the effect, they used it to trade for slaves, especially the New England colonists in particular. They imported a lot of rum from Jamaica, which they drank themselves if they were upper class. They made a lot, which they sold to the local, to the laborers. They often paid the laborers in rum. And then a lot of it was exported to West Africa, which was traded for slaves. And finally, for your area around Detroit, the rum was brought along and through the Great Lakes and was traded for furs and was widely credited with destroying the Indian culture, the Native American culture along there, because it really was like a crack cocaine epidemic before your sort of average Indian trapper would collect enough furs to get himself powder and food and blankets through the winter, and no particular reason for more. But with rum, he was a commodity that he would come back for more and more and more. And they trapped out our whole areas, and it destroyed the culture, the families. And in fact, Benjamin Franklin was sort of regarded this as, he said, if there's one single agent that the Great Spirit has appointed to cleanse the savages from our borders, it's rum. It was consciously used that way.
People drank a lot during that period, didn't they? I mean, much more so than now.
Well, this was the funny thing about the Puritans is they weren't very puritanical, as far as alcohol was concerned, at least. They regarded alcohol as a godly gift of God. And if you look, if you think of the conditions, this was sub-zero, no central heating, scanty food supplies. Alcohol was pure energy. I mean, it sort of not only made life more bearable, but it was actually food. It provided food for people who were working very hard in very cold conditions. And, you know, if you want an example of that, the British Royal Navy, which I've got chapters about, for 3 centuries while Britannia ruled the waves, they did so with every sailor getting a pint of neat overproof rum every day for their ration.
A pint?
It was a pint every day. The ration was divided into 2 halves at one point in an attempt to stop them falling off the yardarm continually.
Wow.
And then they diluted it with water, but that actually just makes it more easy to absorb and digest. So I always thought it was a great miracle that the British Navy ever actually left port, let alone that it won battles the way it did.
Well, go back, if you would, Ian Williams, to what you were talking about, rum and this whole, I've heard it described as a triangle between Jamaica and West Africa and maybe England as well, where it was, you know, growing sugar, the plantations were run by slaves, and then the rum trade was, it was this enormous commodity. How give us an idea of the scope of all of this.
Well, it was the main means of building up New England as an industrial and mercantile district. The sugar went from the West Indies to England mostly, but the molasses went to New England, where it was traded for saltfish, codfish from the Grand Banks, and from timber for all sorts of uses, but above all for making the barrels, and then from New England, the rum was taken to West Africa, where it was traded for slaves, taken across to the West Indies, and traded for molasses. It was too complicated to be a triangle. It was more like a sort of a spider's web or a cat's cradle with all these lines going up and down. But by the time of the Revolution, the New England fleet, the American fleet, the merchant fleet, was almost as big as England's. I mean, it was a huge sort of enterprise on a fairly unpromising and infertile bit of soil. And it was all predicated on this trade, which is why after the Revolution, when the lines were cut, there was a big slump for many years in the new republic.
And rum actually played a role in the American Revolution as well.
Well, it was this molasses we were talking about. At the beginning of the 18th century, the French king, to protect the cognac growers, the cognac makers, and the Spanish king did the same to protect his brandy makers, banned their colonies from producing rum for export. And this meant that in Martinique and Guadeloupe and what is now Haiti, San Domingo as it was then, there were huge lakes of molasses left over after they'd exported the sugar. And the Yankee colonies looked at this and thought, we know how to do with this. So they traded with the French and Spanish colonies for the molasses. And this was a double no-no. One was under the sort of traditional doctrine of the time, they weren't supposed to trade with foreigners. They were only supposed to trade within the British Empire. And the second bit was, of course, for most of the 18th century, we were at war with the French and the Spanish. So the American colonists were trading with the enemy, even through the Indian and the war, French and Indian wars, to get that molasses. And the British Navy was involved in policing it, and this is where the real bad blood that led to the revolution came up, because the British government sneakily actually reduced the taxes on molasses. But the point was that nobody paid the taxes before, so instead of paying a shilling a barrel, a shilling a gallon in taxation that they ignored, they were told there was going to be a penny a gallon, but they had to pay it, and the Navy made them pay it as well. And that caused immense bad blood, and that was really what led up to the revolution. You know, never mind the Boston Tea Party, not even the British fight wars about Earl Grey and Darjeeling. This was about molasses and rum.
The book is Rum, A Social and Sociable History. Our guest is Ian Williams on the Peter Werby Show. Ian Williams is the Nation Magazine's United Nations correspondent. I guess when you mentioned earlier and kind of half-jokingly talked about the British sailors getting a pint of rum a day.
Oh, that's serious. That's deadly.
Well,
serious.
No, I know, but I mean, almost falling off the yardarm. But then you had, and in your book, you talk about Washington's army also being drinking rum all the time. It's a mystery to me. How they were able to fight. Yet the soldiers in the Continental Army expected a rum ration as well?
They wouldn't fight without it. And some of the early battles, it's all covered over now, but some of the early battles were really about trying to seize each other's rum supplies for the winter. And I mean, one of the legends, which has been disputed, but one of the legends is that George Washington actually pulled a really sneaky trick with his first victory, the Battle of Trenton, was because the Hessians had been celebrating Christmas, well, but not too wisely. And, of course, George Washington went across the river in the freezing cold to catch them while they were still sort of celebrating and wassailing Christmas with their rum rations. But the Continental Army took the rum away with them afterwards.
Well, I mentioned earlier, you did, about the availability of rum, and I said that that people drank a lot then. And what I was getting at, I've seen statistics that the amount of alcohol consumption by people in this part of the world has actually decreased, that at that time that there was this immense consumption on the part of individuals, besides just the soldiers and the sailors, so that it was socially acceptable to just be slugging down this rum all the time.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't even just rum. I mean, you have to remember, like in New England, John Adams started his day with a quart of very hard cider every morning. I mean, that must have really put a sort of fur on his teeth. I hope he cleaned his teeth afterwards rather than before. And then they would drink rum during the day. And the usual form, of course, was punch. Benjamin Franklin wrote a sort of poem to punch with the recipe in it. What they would do was they would mix up, it's a sort of prototype junk food. They would mix up cream and sugar in huge quantities along with rum. And then some of the recipes, they would put a red hot poker in and they used what they were called loggerheads for it, which gave it a sort of caramelized, toffee flavor. But that's where the phrase at loggerheads comes from, by the way, because, of course, they had these loggerheads next to the over the hearth, and they often end up hitting each other with them.
Well, and it sounds a little like eggnog.
That's the same basic recipe. People here are surprised that eggnog used to contain rum, and I tell people eggnog is not rum without it is not eggnog without rum. It's an essential part of the mix. And it actually makes a huge difference. Eggnog with rum in it is a very good thing for a cold winter's day, I can assure you.
Yeah, I know. It's a drink. The only thing now, people, it's not so much the alcohol, but it's the cream and the eggs that are in it that kind of make a lot of us pause before drinking a lot of it.
Well, and any excuse, really. But it's still, I was in the Catskills last year, and I was going to a friend, and I knew he liked rum, so I went into a liquor store on the way and said, "Do you have any rums?" And he said, "No, we've had a run on it." I said, "Why?" He said, "It's cold, it's winter." And, you know, so in these parts of New England and presumably in Midwest, there's still this tradition that rum is what you use when it's cold or when you've got a cold, which, of course, doesn't stop you saying it's also what you drink when you're on the beach in the Caribbean.
That's what I was going to say. It's interesting. I visited Cuba in February of last year, and I probably consumed more rum in a week than I did in my entire life. That the mojitos there, besides being about 75 or 80 cents, were just absolutely delicious. Now, where do you think the best rum is being produced today? I can't imagine it being too much better than the stuff I consumed on that island.
Cuban rum, it's good workmanlike stuff. It's not as good as they claim, but of course it has the forbidden fruit bit. It's under the embargo. You're not supposed to drink it. So if I produce a bottle of Havana Club 7-year-old, people will love it just because it's the thrill of the forbidden. But my personal favorite for many years has been rum Barbancourt from Haiti, 15-year-old special estate reserve, mm-hmm. which is really like a fine cognac. And then recently I've discovered from Guatemala the rum Zacapa, which is 23-year-old. And there they actually they distill it in the plains and then take it 15,000 feet up to age gracefully. But there are many more. I mean, you know, Mount Gay, Extra Old, the Appletons. And I think the English-speaking Caribbean has just begun to catch on that you can age this and get a lot more money for it later on. Because I think the great Anglo-Saxon tradition in the Caribbean still was why waste it by keeping it lying around in cellars evaporating when you can drink it hot, you know,
there you go.
As fast as it comes. And if ever you've had the white overproof rum in some of these countries that they sell in the rum shops, you can see there's a lot to be said for not letting it evaporate quickly, because it will do.
Well, let's just go back. Actually, I want to talk about Cuban rum and some of the disputes around Cuban rum. But before we leave the colonial period, so here with rum, as you indicate in your book, Ian Williams, by that name, that you have its centrality, both economically but also playing a big role in the military. When did it cease playing a big role?
It was after the Revolution. First of all, and we're talking about America in particular now, after the Revolution, the trading connections with the Caribbean were cut because the colonists really expected the Caribbean islands to come with them.
Mm-hmm.
But the Caribbean islands still had the French and the Spanish next to them. So even though they sympathized with the colonists, they weren't going to give up the protection of the British, because this was the other part of the equation of the Revolution, of course, was that the British had driven the French out of Canada. So the British army was no longer, and the British Navy were no longer necessary for the American colonists on the mainland, because the threat was removed. That wasn't true in the Caribbean, so that trading system was broken. And the other part was that the King of England had signed treaties with the Indians during the wars of the French and Indians that basically stopped the colonists from going over the Appalachians, you know, from going over the mountains, the Appalachians, and stopped the westward movement. So one of the reasons why the colonists were so upset was they wanted to disrupt that and rip up the treaties, which of course they promptly did. And once they got over into places like Kentucky, they had this incredibly fertile corn-growing land. And there's nothing else they could do with the corn, because they couldn't take it down the Mississippi. They couldn't take it across the mountains because, you know, with ox carts, the transport was so expensive. So they distilled it into whiskey. And those whiskey supplies were really, from the turn of the 19th century, 1800s onwards, whiskey became more and more the American drink. And whiskey makers actually pushed this as well, of course, because they sort of decided in the best traditions of advertising and lobbying that rum was an evil imperial colonial drink while whiskey was a pure federal spirit, and I'm quoting there. And so by 1811, I think I remember, you can check, you have the book in front of you, that the U.S. Navy even, they had continued the grog ration that the British had instituted, but they substituted whiskey for it. I presume a sort of lobbyist in Washington wanted the contract.
Well, I know that that one of the complaints in the Declaration of Independence against King George III by the colonists were that they weren't being allowed, as you said, to go beyond the Appalachians and to gobble up more Indian land. Now, after the Civil War, The Republicans denounced the Democrats as being the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. Romanism, of course, being the Catholic Church, and rebellion relating to the American Civil War. So it actually was sort of a pejorative that, it was an alliteration, of course, with three R's. But it's interesting, I always thought, why they picked rum as a as part of that denunciation of the Democrats of the time.
Well, I think it was rum was also the Republicans were strong in the interior in the Midwest, where the East Coast was still partial to rum. It was much easier to get rum than it was whiskey. Boston was still distilling a huge amount of rum. This was where the Irish Catholics were coming in. This was where the rebellion and the pro-rebellion sentiment was in the big cities. And there's a picture that we couldn't include because we couldn't get a good enough reproduction, but it's sort of iconic. There's a Courier and Ives print of George Washington bidding farewell to his troops in Francis Tavern in New York, that which is still there, as you know. And in the picture, the print that was published in 1848, you have Washington holding up a glass with a carafe on the table behind him. In 1868, the rise of prohibitionist sentiment was such that the new edition of it had him sort of clutching his lapel in a vaguely Napoleonic way. The carafe on the table had turned into a big cocked hat, and none of his officers had a glass in their hands either. So, you know, it had moved from being his toast to his officers to his farewell to his officers.
Wow.
So it was already going down the memory hole after the Civil War.
Well, I'm just noticing we only have about 2 minutes left, and not a lot of time to bring the modern struggle over rum, the politics still dominating that between Havana Club and Bacardi. Bacardi, Cubans who left after the Cuban Revolution, and the whole deal about the labels and all of that. Jeb Bush is in on this. Any way to give? I mean, it's very complex, but any way to give us a shorthand?
The short version is the Bacardi family actually bankrolled Fidel Castro up in the Sierra Maestra before the revolution. And then after the revolution, they even went on trade missions with the new revolutionary government. However, Fidel Castro then went and nationalized them, and this left them seriously upset, and that upset is still sort of going on 50 years later. But Bacardi was the first multinational. They already had set up a plant in Puerto Rico in anticipation of the end of Prohibition, so they could be a U.S. Supplier. They had opened up their offices in the Bahamas, which made them a British Empire preference. That they were offshore, so actually the nationalization of their Cuban enterprises didn't affect them that much, except in their pride, which there's a lot of, and they were very offended.
Well, they're still concerned about the name. Is it the Havana Club that is that?
Well,
the
they never actually produced Havana Club. What they did was they went to the family that used to produce Havana Club and bought up the name, his claims to the name, which incidentally had actually lapsed in law because they hadn't renewed the trademark. But basically, they were just trying to. First of all, they were trying to create a nuisance for Fidel for the fairly obvious reasons. But secondly, the Bacardi family is the Bacardi brand is very jealous and tries to keep out other rum brands. And the Havana Club has been doing extremely well in Europe. It's you know selling by the barrel in Britain and France and Europe. So. They didn't want this to happen. They didn't want serious competition on their home territory in the States. So they fought tooth and nail, both for commercial reasons and for reasons of political vengeance against the Cubans on this issue.
Well, one memory I have from Cuba, there were young men with little sugar presses. They'd take about a foot-long sugar cane stem and grind it. Out would come this sugar water, and this would just be out in the street or something. They'd dump a shot of I don't know, rum. I'm not sure what the quality
was.
Yes,
it wouldn't be very good quality. But no, that's the way mojitos should be drunk. I mean, I have been to parties at the Cuban Mission here in New York, and they just put white granulated sugar in with mint and shove the rum in, and it's pretty much what you'd expect from a Soviet-style drinking factory. But the original stuff, it is indeed, you get the sugar cane and you put it through that little grinder, and it comes out. It's much... and the mojito, by the way, when you think about the mojito, is pretty much the same as the mint julep, the same as the caipirinha, the same as the tea punch. And apart from your eggnog recipes, This is one of the classic ways to drink rum across the world, with sugar and some citrus fruit and some herbs in there. And it's a wonderful concoction. Next best thing to drinking good rum neat, I would say.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Ian Williams. The book is Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. It is a Nation book. You can go to nationbooks.org, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and there'll be a link there as well. Ian Williams, thanks so much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
It's been fun. I wish we could have clinked the glass.
Indeed. Thanks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Junior's
WRIF.com. Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you and a pleasure to bring back someone who's been on the program before. Not in a few years, though, but you probably have heard me mention the group that he founded any number of times. His name is Jeff Cohn. He's a native Detroiter. He's the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's the progressive media watch group that's based in New York. We also get other guests from Fair on as well. Jeff was an on-air commentator at MSNBC, a senior producer on Donahue until the show was canceled on the eve of the Iraq War. He was a weekly panelist on Fox News Channel's Newswatch, and he's also co-hosted CNN's Crossfire, and he's been a frequent guest on national TV, including Larry King Live, The O'Reilly Factor, C-SPAN. He's co-authored a number of books. He's an old friend as well. Jeff Cohn, welcome home.
Hey, it's great to be listened to in Detroit, my hometown.
Yeah, that's right. So your brand-new book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Now, I was substituting on Air America for the old Mike Malloy show a few months ago, and I interviewed you about this book, and we said we would do it here in Detroit. But there's been a change. The Republicans royally got their butt kicked in November, and I feel like I would be asking a different set of questions. Do you get that same feeling, or would your answers be the same? Has there been a sea change in cable news as well?
There has definitely not been. In fact, I think the voters resoundingly said, we want a change in the faces of those who represent us in Washington, but we have the same old crowd representing us in TV punditry. I know the whole crowd because I was part of the hot air brigade. But it's a white male club, largely. The spectrum of views goes from the corporate center to the far right. It's a spectrum no broader than from GE to GM. It's a spectrum of views in mainstream TV punditry that has a lot of contempt for grassroots activists, for labor union activists, for peace activists. And if you were watching, like, on the night that the American people resoundedly defeated the right wing and said, we want new leadership, we want a change, especially on the Iraq War, what you got from TV punditry was either fear that the Democrats would change things too much, or sort of overly stated assurances that, well, a lot of these Democrats, they're just as conservative as the Republicans, so right. we can rest happy. It's a big issue for me that the full spectrum of the American people has never been shown on TV, and each year it tends to get worse no matter what happens, and, you know, no matter what upsurges there might be against corporate trade deals or ridiculous and immoral wars, no matter what the upsurges are in society, it's the same little beltway club in Washington that dominates TV punditry. It's more propaganda than it is analysis.
Well, Jeff Cohn, why did they do this? Now, why I ask that, I was just out in the hall talking about rock and roll programming with the program director here, and they do everything imaginable to get on the air what they think that the listeners want to hear. I mean, and there's such a broad spectrum, of course, of music.
Right.
How do you get that on? Whereas this sounds like somebody that's going, you know, the way you describe cable news is like they're going to play what they want to play. It doesn't make a bit of sense. I mean, like, they don't have me as a viewer, because I figure this is a lot.
Right.
Like you said, I don't want to watch that, so I don't do it. I'm an underserved audience. You think they would be fighting to get my views on there?
Well, the argument you've just made to me is the argument I made to the management of these cable news channels for about 20 years. And there's a myth that they're giving us a marketplace of viewpoints. What they're giving us is a narrow stream of viewpoints that are all corporately approved. When I was being tried out for the permanent co-host from representing the left on CNN's Crossfire, which at that time was by far the biggest, most raucous debate show on TV, and I described that in detail in the book, it was clear to me that one thing management was worried about was sponsor flight. They were worried that if they had a genuine progressive on the air every night in Crossfire, like me.
And who would win?
And who would do well, who would not be retreating,
yeah.
who would not be backpedaling, who would not be apologizing to the right winger. They were worried that I might be sometimes attacking the sponsor. And the sponsor of Crossfire at the time was General Electric, a company I was well known to be a critic of. So one factor is that minimizes, that blunts a true marketplace of viewpoints on cable news and elsewhere in the media, is the fear of sponsor flight, that you first have to make sure you won't offend the sponsors. The sponsors have impact on narrowing the viewpoints allowed. And then when I got in there deeper and I had more conversations with TV news management, I realized that there was also this legacy of McCarthyism going on, that McCarthyism in the 1950s and the blacklist of people that were suspect because they were too progressive, they were for peace, they were for civil rights prematurely. You know, that's where television was born. It was born in the 1950s. And in the 1950s, even into the 1960s, in television, every executive had a blacklist that certain actors and writers and directors could not work in television. And it was people on the left side of the spectrum. And what I noticed beginning in the 80s and 90s was that TV news executives, there was never any fear if they put a far right winger like Glenn Beck or Pat Buchanan or Bob Novak or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly. It didn't matter, no matter how far right you were. But when it came to putting on analysts and commentators who were to the left of center, the group that is often called un-American, anti-American, unpatriotic, doesn't support the troops, doesn't support this war or that war, that left side of the spectrum has always been smeared, and executives have always tilted toward the right in fear that if they hire a Jim Hightower, a Peter Werbe, or someone like that and put them on national TV, that they will be suspect as soft on subversives, soft on un-Americans. And there's never been this fear of putting on the extreme right, but there's always been this fear in media executives of having, you know, the genuine, bona fide, proud representative of the progressive left.
Well, Jeff Cohen, you, to some extent, broke the mold at MSNBC, where you were an on-air commentator, but also you were the senior producer on Donahue, and that was canned right on the eve of the Iraq War. So that's sort of illustrative of what you were saying. Maybe you could quickly tell us the story of that and how that fits your point, because that was a successful program, right?
Yeah, it was successful. I mean, how often, when it was canceled, the Donahue primetime show on MSNBC 3 weeks before the Iraq War, it was the most watched program on MSNBC. And it's, again, if there was a real marketplace, then, wow, the viewers are watching this more than our other shows. We're certainly not going to cancel it. But it's not a real marketplace of ideas, and management canceled their most watched program. Why? Well, we learned a day after we were canceled, when a memo leaked out, thank God for whistleblowers, someone leaked a memo, and I know a lot of reporters thought it was me, but I'd never seen the memo till it started being quoted in the press. The memo said, quote, Donahue represents a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then the NBC memo went on to describe their nightmare scenario where Donahue would become, and I'm quoting, a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. So, I mean, NBC, and we knew this, by the way, in the months prior to the cancellation. From the minute we went on the air in July 2002 until we were canceled 3 weeks before the war started in Iraq in February 03, they had turned the screws tighter and tighter. In the last few months, we were instructed every time we booked a guest who was anti-war, we had to book two guests that were pro-war. If we booked two guests on the left, we had to have three on the right. At one meeting, a producer suggested booking Michael Moore as a guest, and she was told she'd had to have three right-wingers for ideological balance against Michael Moore. And, you know, my joke was that I privately thought about proposing Noam Chomsky as a guest.
Whoa.
But our stage couldn't accommodate the 28 right-wingers we would have needed for balance.
There you go.
So, I mean, I was on the air in May, June, July, August, every afternoon I debated a different right winger. And then I got taken off the air because they had to make room on MSNBC for a new show called Countdown Iraq, which didn't have real debates. It had the former generals and the former colonels and the alleged weapons of mass destruction experts. And almost everything these experts said, and they never had to be in debates. You know, I couldn't discuss the weather on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN without being balanced by at least one fire-breathing right-winger. But these people from the Pentagon, the retired brass, the military, and the so-called weapons experts that were sometimes former CIA guys, they weren't in debates. We now look back on what they said, and almost all of it was wrong that helped us get into this war based on a pretense that Iraq represented some threat to us. And you look back, this is the focus of my book. You look back on it, and you see that those of us who were right about the war, those of us who said, wait a second, what kind of threat is Iraq? And we said, it's going to be chaos. It's going to be, we're going into an unstable region. A war there will just destabilize the region even more. Those of us who said that, I said it, Phil Donahue said it as the host of the Primetime Donahue show on MSNBC, we got banished from the system. I haven't been asked back since that time. But the people that were wrong about Iraq, and just egregiously wrong, ridiculously wrong, 180 degrees factually wrong, I see these people on the air all the time, and now they say we should do some military action against Iran.
They suffer no consequences, do they?
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
And that's the essence of the book. You know, Jerry Falwell can make any wild statement, any false statement. He lives on TV. Ann Coulter, any false statement, outlandish, hateful statement, she lives on TV. Frank Gaffney, he's on TV now barking about why we need to be tough about Iran. I debated him on MSNBC. He's a former Reagan defense official. I once had to debate him where he was saying, not that this is before the Iraq war, not only was Saddam Hussein behind 9/11 terror attacks, which is false, but that Saddam Hussein in Iraq was behind Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing. I swear to God. And, you know, I remember before that debate, I said, why are we wasting time? You know, it matters. I said this to the young producer who is booking it. So why am I debating Gaffney about something ludicrous? We're on the eve of war. It matters what we do. And what I saw was those of us who were acting journalistically and independently, we've been banished from the system. Those who believe it's just showbiz and don't irritate the brass and don't irritate the White House and don't irritate the Pentagon, those kinds of corporate careerists, they've seen their careers flourish, even though they're complicit in deluding the American public about the reasons for the invasion of Iraq. That's been, I think we all agree, one of the great foreign policy disasters in our country's history. But the people in the media that were accountable, that were responsible for it, have never been held accountable.
Jeff Cohen is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. There's a foreword by Jim Hightower. The book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. It's published by Polypoint Press. You can go to p3books.com. And Jeff Cohen, you have a site for the book, don't you, as well?
One site is jeffcohen.org,
okay,
and another is cablenewsconfidential.com.
All right, and I will have a link on my site, peterwerbe.com, and we'll give that again towards the end of our conversation. And but how do you explain now the Keith Olbermann factor? Because suddenly, I never watched cable news hardly at all, suddenly people started mentioning this guy, and it's like, I don't know whether he just arose from the sea or what, and I've turned on his commentaries, and I'm thinking, why am I broadcasting? This guy is saying it all.
I was an exception in cable news, and when I lasted, I appeared every week for 5 years on Fox News Channel. So it's an exception. We are not a totalitarian society, thank God. Because of that, there are exceptions in the media. The rules remain. that the spectrum of views favors the right wing, favors the corporate view over the labor, consumer rights, environmental peace view. That you know, FAIR, as you know, Peter, with the people you've interviewed from FAIR over the years, FAIR has documented all of this in studies. But there's always exceptions. And the recent exception, the fluky exception, is Keith Olbermann. He's a sports guy. He, you know, his career was really built at ESPN. And then he went over there sort of when Donahue was getting terminated and I was getting terminated at MSNBC. He was over at MSNBC, and he was getting muzzled. Like once he put on, in the space of 2 or 3 days, he put on the actress Janine Garofalo, who was anti-war, and the writer and comedian Al Franken.
Yeah,
sure. And for doing that, management came out and said to him, hey, why all the liberals? Like, it was two guests over a period of a few days, and he got talked to by management. So, you know, he was being muzzled, too, during that era. And I think what we've realized is that the zeitgeist, the political zeitgeist, the political environment has changed. It's changed a little bit after the election. It changed a lot in the previous year. Especially around Katrina, and then as the Iraq war became more and more of a debacle and a disaster. So Keith Olbermann has gotten bolder and bolder as the zeitgeist has changed. And I still, you know, I wrote a column, Is Keith Olbermann on Thin Ice? Because it's the same management that I had. MSNBC is owned by General Electric, which makes a lot of money from war, makes money from nuclear power, makes money from environmental degradation. And General Electric owns that channel and so many others. And we know what their management is about. Keith Olbermann himself went on C-SPAN about March of this year and said, look, I know that the people in the management of GE, the hierarchy of GE and NBC, they would be happy if there was absolutely no criticism of this current presidential administration. I know that. But I think Olbermann has got a good sense that there's an opening. You know, when I was with the Donahue show, Bush's popularity was very high, and the war hadn't started yet. With Olbermann now getting out and saying what he's saying, Bush's popularity is almost an all-time low, and the war is a debacle. So as I say in the book, you know, you learn when you're working at these corporate hierarchies that one of the worst things that can happen to you if you're a journalist is to do anything that could get you accused of being a liberal or get your channel accused of being liberal. And the big fear is of offending the powers that be, the economic powers that be, the political powers that be, especially if they're conservative, especially if they're riding high. The only time you can kick the conservatives is when they're down, and believe me, they're down. And I think that's why Olbermann is in a much more fortuitous situation. He's in a better frame now to try to push the envelope. But if things went the other way,
mm-hmm.
if there was some new horrible event and clampdown on civil liberties, believe me, Keith Olbermann wouldn't be able to say what he's saying.
He'd be gone. Jeff Cohen, you're continuing to write in your role as a pundit, and I see you have you just sent it to me, something that you published on commondreams.org, a site I would recommend to people. TV blowhard barks at Iran, let's hold CNN accountable. So the left hand giveth us Keith Olbermann, the right hand taketh, and that's Glenn Beck. Now, this guy is a far-right-wing Clear Channel talk show host. Suddenly he wants another war. We're not doing real well with this one. What's
well, and the point of the column is these people that helped get us into the last war have never been accountable. Glenn Beck, a creature in many ways of Clear Channel, who is syndicating his show, you know, he organized the so-called pro-America rallies. And he used Clear Channel to do that, and he called Cindy Sheehan, you know, the really big prostitute, and he wished the death of Michael Moore and my friend Congressman Dennis Kucinich. And, you know, you have a guy like that who, like, was just egging us on into the last Iraq war, and now he's, like, pushing for more militant action and military action against Iran, and no one says, wait a second. Explain to us how you were so wrong on the Iraq war, and then I'll listen to you about Iran. And that never has to happen. Those military analysts, the so-called experts, who were so wrong about weapons of mass destruction, so wrong about how easy this war would be in Iraq. It would be a cakewalk. They said it would, you know, the Iraqi people would be welcoming us with American flags. These people that were so wrong still are all over TV and radio. And a guy like Glenn Beck has never been held accountable for being so wrong and egging on the last war, but now he wants to egg on the new war.
Yeah, it's amazing. You're wrong. I mean, it's unlike most businesses where when you make mistakes, usually you go the other way. Jeff Cohn's my guest. The book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. You know, I often ask this question when I interview people from the group you founded, Jeff, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, and in a sense, the question is suggested by your book as well. I when I speak about the media publicly, I always say, how many people here think the media is doing its job? And you know where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. And no one raises their hand. And I say, I disagree. I think they're doing their job just perfectly. The view we have, in a sense, in the abstract, is that it is a medium from taking what's happening out there in the world and to us to let us know what's going on in a variety of different opinions. Well, obviously, the media has never been like that. The major corporate media has always, throughout American history, has always been on the other side of the kind of struggles that people have had to make this even slightly a decent country. So, I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
You know what the importance of it is that it exposes to people, and that's what's so good about your book and the work of FAIR, how biased these outlets are. But I'm actually hopeless about that they would ever be reformed to really give fairness and accuracy in reporting.
Yeah, well, that may be the case. I know a lot of the young journalists who go into the media really go in idealistically, and they go in publicly minded. And I know people are raised in the schools in this country to expect fairness and a wide spectrum, a real debate in the mainstream media. That's how we're taught. And I remember when I was growing up in Detroit in the schools, you know, we had a free press and the Soviet communist system was totalitarian, and they were certainly right about the Soviet system, but we would often be given a lot of overly uplifting propaganda about our own system, especially the media system. So you're right. In some senses, these corporations are doing what they intend to do, which is to function as weapons of mass distraction, to put advertising first, to not rile the boat, to keep people angry, but not angry about the economic powers that be, angry about gays or feminists or long-haired hippie peaceniks or immigrants or what have you.
Crime.
Yeah,
crime, so the criminal.
Right,
O.J. O.J.
Right. Yeah. O.J. says runaway bride, you name it. But clearly the corporate media system functions as those at the top want it to function. I still think it's good for people to speak out and make demands of the mainstream media. If anything were ever to happen to Peter Werbe in Detroit and you being silenced, I would fly to Detroit and join demonstrations for you.
Okay.
And that's what I think, that's the importance, that yes, the media are not fair toward these progressive social movements that represent millions of people, that's true, but we should still make demands upon them while building our own independent outlets. The beauty of the last few years, and my book actually ends on an optimistic note, the beauty is that independent media are booming. You know the joke at The Nation magazine, Bush may be horrible for the country, but he's great for The Nation. You know, and independent websites, you mentioned commondreams.org, it's absolutely booming. Alternet.org is booming. Amy Goodman's show, which is a public radio TV collaboration, is booming. These blogs that started in 2002 now have millions. I'm talking about Daily Kos. The great cartoonist Tom Tomorrow has his blog, This Modern World, Atrios. These things started in 2002. They got millions of people going to them. And the beauty of the Internet, which is, I think, the key to the success of so much nonprofit and independent media, the beauty of the Internet is it's a small D democratic media. When you attack someone on the Internet, you're supposed to link to what you're attacking. And certainly that's the ethic of bloggers. And then someone and the people reading that can read both what you're saying, the person you're attacking is saying, and then they can join the debate. So the internet is very much communication from the many to the many. It's the exact opposite of Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, who are the demagogues who talk, you know, the individuals preaching to the millions, and the millions say back to them, dittos, Rush.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, Jeff Cohen, as usual. You can go to jeffcohen.org, C-O-H-E-N. Jeff's latest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. It's published by Polypoint Press. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Jeff, thanks as usual for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
This is WRIN.com.
Grandma's old radio. Oh, wouldn't it be grand to get around and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live in infamy.
Good evening, adults. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a very special presentation.
Boring. Go back to that infamy guy.
101 FM WRIF Detroit. Slayer here back in tonight, taking you up to Drew and Mike in the morning. This time I'm in following Peter Werby and Julian Jordan Night Call on the Riff exclusively on 101 WRIF Detroit. Each and every Sunday night you can catch that here. Lots of stuff coming up on the show tonight, including right in just a couple minutes, we'll do that Deep Field track, okay? It's been pretty popular. Get lots of calls, emails for that one. We'll crank it out. It's called Get It. We'll do that just a little bit. We'll also do the new.